It's like shit. I said, we don't have to worry about it because he's definitely going to die at some point soon, and then we can all like dance. We can have a celebration. That'll be probably one of the first times on the internet that I will probably post something like a celebratory post, you know? And I mean that. I'm not even joking. I'm deadly serious. Like, I cannot wait for that man to die.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered!
You like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
That was Kip Sabian on his Twitch stream, ready to party like it's 1999 when Jim Cornette finally bites the dust. He and Miro were throwing all kinds of sad tweets around this weekend, very upset with Cornette over his comments about Kip's wife, Penelope Ford, on his podcast while he was reviewing their match at Revolution. He said, "Miro does this stupid shit and obviously is enjoying himself doing it. He was paired with a kid that looks like he's in middle school and his slutty girlfriend." Penelope Ford also responded to someone on Twitter, I guess, who sent some kind of message to her. Said, "I mean, he has said that multiple times, I guess, about her. But he lets people F his wife while he watches, so what does he think of her? But she's probably the only person besides himself he feels bad for because his little dick can't please her after five blue chews and needs other men to do it for him." Starting early with sad tweet this week, people. Look, the man is sticking up for his wife. But I don't know what Miro is on about. You know, he's out there tweeting at Cornette that he's a mark. Answer me, you mark. I'll personally drive to your basement. This is just sad. And because of all of this, because of what Miro got started here, the name Cornette was trending on Twitter worldwide for hours yesterday. They gave him exactly what he wanted. Now I'm sure everybody will be tuning in to see what his response is. I'm just waiting for Randy Orton and Soulja Boy to jump into the discussion. This is episode 695 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, March 14, 2021. You know, it feels like we're inching our way closer to normal. 1,300 fans inside Daly's Place for the AEW Revolution pay-per-view last Sunday. And this Tuesday, WrestleMania tickets go on sale through Ticketmaster, priced from $35 all the way up to $2,500 per night. They're also offering two-day combo tickets for those who want to attend both nights. Per the Observer, the hope internally is to put 45,000 people in the building each night, which sounds scary, but on Wednesday, the city of Tampa met with hotels in the area, and the hotels were told that WWE is pushing to run at 75% capacity on both nights, which in that stadium, with the stage and the setup and everything, would have been around 60 to 65,000 fans under normal conditions. I will not be there, but if you're ready to get back to live events, good luck, because they're only putting a limited number of tickets on sale this week. So I would try to get in early on that if you really want to go. But it feels like slowly but surely, we are getting back to a sense of normal. I look forward to getting out of the Thunderdome and getting out of Daly's Place. As nice of a venue as Daly's Place is, I'm sick of it at this point. And back to wrestling shows, hopefully by the end of the year, in front of a mostly full audience. I look forward to that day. If you want to support the show, there's a lot of ways to do that. Of course, One of the ways you can do that is by using our Audible link. So you get a little something for it. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. You can get yourself a 30-day trial of the service. Sample it. Try it out. And in so doing, you get yourself one free audiobook of your choosing. Doesn't have to be a wrestling book, but there's a damn good number of wrestling books that are available through Audible. And even if you cancel the trial so you don't get billed on day 29, that book belongs to you forever. When you use our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. And of course, if you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so. On the Solomonster.com, you'll see that PayPal button on the right-hand side of your page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. And I want to say thank you to Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Ostentatious Alan Carter, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, the Firebomber Craig Foster, Dark Sky Dixon Krasinski, the Wichita Workhorse Clayton Nettleton. We have the return of the Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Camelotes, the Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, and of course, our good friend Belt Fan Brent Banner says, where you get a tattoo is very important. Well, I should know. I mean, you can't see it right now, but I have tattoos all over my body. It's one of the big secrets about Solomonster that you didn't know. Almost as important as checking out the How Did We Even Get Here podcast. This week, the boys discuss interesting locations for those tattoos that people get of their kids' faces. Plus the FU of the week and good vibes only. All that this week on episode 60 of the How Did We Even Get Here podcast, available everywhere you can find your favorite podcast and on YouTube at tinyurl.com/getheretube. And World Wrestling Straya, that's Straya, is on YouTube. Adam from FWCI is the host, and he talks all about the news with the Aussies in WWE, as well as all the headlines from the world of wrestling. This week, he talks about AEW's actions with the follow-up to their misplosion from Revolution. He also wonders why Murphy is being used as nothing but a jobber the past 2 weeks. He's also giving away a bunch of wrestling figures, including Pentagon Jr.'s first ever AEW figure. Just search World Wrestling Straya on YouTube, or you can also search for FWCI ETC on YouTube to find him. So this week is a pretty big week, especially if you are a WWE Network subscriber, because this Thursday, March 18th, WWE Network officially launches on Peacock. They will begin rolling out content leading up to next Sunday's Fastlane pay-per-view, which will air on both Peacock and the standalone traditional WWE Network, which is going away. We now have an official drop date for when the network here in the U.S. is going to be shut down, and that date is April 4th. That is the date that the WWE Network, as we know it here in this country, doesn't really affect any other country, only here in the U.S., that is the date, as we know it, that it will cease to exist on its own. And both nights of WrestleMania will be the first pay-per-view to air exclusively on Peacock. Fastlane is sort of the guinea pig, I think, to make sure things go smoothly. But this is from the press release that they issued this week. WWE will have a dedicated page on Peacock where fans can browse across every pay-per-view event in the last calendar year. Current or most recent season episodes of Steve Austin's Broken Skull Sessions, WWE Chronicle, and WWE Icons, as well as weekly episodes of NXT the day after they air on TV, and 2021 replays of Raw and SmackDown 30 days after air, plus groundbreaking documentaries including Undertaker, The Last Ride, WWE 24, and WWE Untold, reality series including Total Bellas, and collections of featured series, topical moments like Stone Cold Steve Austin Week, which is all this week, by the way, because Tuesday is 316. So they have a whole week of Steve Austin-related programming. Peacock will continue, and this is the part of the press release that really made me kind of sit up straight, not in a good way. Peacock will continually add WWE Network content to the library, making the entire WWE Network archive, including every WWE, WCW, and ECW pay-per-view, available to stream on demand before SummerSlam. It says when WWE sunsets the existing standalone network app on April 4, Peacock will be the exclusive streaming home to the network here in the U.S. To continue streaming WWE Network content, fans will need to sign up for Peacock. So if you are a Comcast Xfinity customer, let me just mention this first. You already get Peacock Premium at no additional cost. So you already get it for free. You don't have to do anything. But here are the key details as we know them now. Because WWE and Peacock have been very slow to give out information. This is the first week where we really got a lot of information. April 4th, like I said, the network as we know it will cease to exist here in this country. If you are in the UK or any other country, this does not affect you. You will need to sign up for a Peacock account if you don't already have one. Your WWE Network account. I know at first some people thought, well, maybe they'll automatically migrate you over and you won't have to do anything. Not the case. You will have to manually go ahead and set up a Peacock account on your own. And as I feared, if you subscribe to the network, like I subscribe to the network for, you know, pretty much everything. I have to watch, obviously, the current pay-per-views. I love the Broken Skull sessions and some of the documentaries. There's a lot of great content on there. But I am a fan of the classic content. And if you are a fan of the old pay-per-views, if you are a fan of other territories, if you are a fan of the episodes they have up of Superstars and Primetime and Wrestling Challenge and all that good stuff, it will not be available in its entirety on Peacock. Not for a while. And they don't even have the full library on the network now. It's not like everything is on there. It has taken years. It has taken this long for them to even get to the point where they have the content they have digitized and uploaded to the network. And now it is going to take at least until the summer for them to return all of that classic content exactly to where it is right now. Now, I didn't expect them to just push a button and port everything over on day one. But what I do wish is that they either would have started working on this sooner, or they would have delayed the migration until more of the library was ready for prime time. But yeah, the library is not their top priority. Their top priority is WrestleMania. It just feels like this all came together in a rush very quickly, and they wanted to make sure that this was done so that WrestleMania could be the first exclusive Peacock-only pay-per-view. That's why they're moving as quickly as they are. But I think that sucks. Now, according to an article on TheVerge.com, if you're a fan of the match markers for shows where you can quickly skip to what you want, which are very helpful, especially, you know, if I'm referencing something, for example, I want to go back and just watch or rewatch something when I'm researching and putting together the history segment, I'm a little fuzzy on my memory of something, so it's very convenient for me to just go to the network, and if it's a particular segment, those match markers have come in very handy for me. I'm sure many of you are probably fans of it as well. There will be no more match markers on the WWE Network on Peacock, at least not initially. Maybe months down the road they'll implement something like that, but there will be no more match markers. If you are looking for a specific match or a specific segment, you will just have to scrub through the show and find it yourself. They also say the search function will not be as robust as it currently is on the network. I'm really hoping that in time they get their act together with this. I have said for years, you've heard me on this podcast, For all the talk about WWE creative, right, and all the criticism and the stuff I've said, the one thing that I rarely have any criticism for, although I have argued for years that we need a live mute button for the commentary, and I am deadly serious I want that to be a feature. I refuse to believe that it is an impossible thing to implement with all the technology we have here in this country and in this world. I know it can be done, and I'm still waiting for that to be done. But I have said for years the network is a steal. You know, even for $9.99, it is a steal for the amount of content, current and classic, that you have access to. I love the network. And this change does not inspire a lot of confidence that the stuff that I want to watch is either going to be there, or that, honestly, it's going to be any real priority for the folks at Peacock to get it uploaded in a timely way in the future. Is you know, getting the next year's worth of old Superstars episodes really going to be a priority for the people at Peacock? Probably not. So a lot of what I'm hearing, I don't like. But if ever, and this is a cheap plug here, but I do think this could actually be legitimately helpful to a lot of people. If ever there was a time for you to take advantage of our ExpressVPN offer, this is it. Now, I cannot sit here and say for sure that this will work the way that it does, for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber. And there's content, you know, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you know that shows and movies, they get cycled off of Netflix all the time. They don't just put stuff up and it sits there forever. Stuff is constantly being added, and when stuff is added, other stuff is taken off the service. So it may not work that same way, where if stuff is taken off of the US version of Netflix, but let's say there's a movie I really want to see, and it's on the German version of Netflix, or the UK version of Netflix, you can use a VPN to spoof your location and get access to the content that way. Because you already have a Netflix account. All you need to do is trick it into thinking that you're in a different part of the world, and all of a sudden, you can watch that movie, or you can watch that TV show. The difference here, and the reason why I'm not 100% sure if this will work the same way as a workaround, is that the WWE Network in the US next month is totally shutting down. You will no longer have a WWE Network account. You will have a Peacock account. So you are not going to be billed by WWE Network anymore. So it is possible this may not work. We won't know for sure until next month, but you should be using a VPN anyway. A lot of people have signed up with our link this week. I think you should too. The link to use is expressvpn.com/Solomonster. And when you use that link and you sign up for a year, which is what it is, it's for a 12-month plan, you get an extra 3 months free. So you're getting 15 months instead of 12. So I just put that out there for those of you who are interested. But we also learned this week that WWE will stream what I assume is going to be a virtual Hall of Fame ceremony on Tuesday, April 6th on Peacock, with the current plan to include the entire 2020 Hall of Fame class, who did not get to give speeches last year, in addition to brand new inductees for 2021. So Dave Bautista, Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, and Sean Waltman representing the NWO, the Bella Twins, JBL, the British Bulldog, only one of them, Davey Boy Smith, and Jushin Thunder Liger. That was your 2020 class. The plan is for them to get their inductions this year. And also, the first inductee for the 2021 class was announced this week on The Bump. They had her on as a special guest, and then all of a sudden, here comes Shane Helms. He's on screen for a special announcement, and this person had no idea what was going on, and Shane Helms was on The Bump to announce that Molly Holly, Mighty Molly, remember Mighty Molly and the Hurricane? Molly Holly is the first inductee into the 2021 class of the WWE Hall of Fame. And she was totally caught by surprise and was so grateful for it. And I like Molly. I think Molly is a fine choice. I think that Shad Gaspard should be a shoo-in for the Warrior Award. If they have the Warrior Award this year, then I think he's a no-brainer for that. The last time we saw Andrade on WWE television, Andrade Cien Almas, was October of last year. He lost a match to Angel Garza, another man who has all but disappeared off the face of the earth, although at least he's made a few appearances on TV in recent months. At the time, it was reported that Andrade was undergoing some sort of minor, I think, elective surgery. I don't know what it was. Nothing serious, nothing that would keep him out for very long. And that he would be back shortly thereafter. Only he never came back. He has been backstage at the shows, but he has not been used on TV. He has not been mentioned, he has not been used. And he must not be very happy about that, because Wrestling Inc. first reported this week, and it has since been corroborated by Fightful and PW Insider and The Observer, that Andrade requested his release from WWE backstage at Raw last Monday night. PW Insider reports that Andrade was said to be looking absolutely miserable at Raw this past week. I mean, it's Raw. Absolutely miserable are two words I associate with that show every week. But I never really fully appreciated how great of a wrestler Andrade was until I saw his TakeOver Philadelphia match with Johnny Gargano. I knew he had a reputation coming into the company when he was first signed as a great wrestler, as La Sombra, before he ever even set foot in NXT. I heard all about him. Didn't see a whole lot of his work. That match is still one of the two best NXT title matches that I have ever seen. That and the first Gargano-Cole match from TakeOver New York. Just an outstanding match. Zelina Vega was great in that match too. Everybody played their part to perfection. The action was great. The near falls, the crowd reaction, everything about that. I guess the only thing really missing was a big heroic babyface win in the end for Johnny Gargano. It was the heel who went over. That's about the only thing that may have taken that match up one more level. But even with the heel going over, it was an absolutely fantastic match. And that Zelina Vega-Andrade pairing was perfect, and it did not need to be broken up. But as with a lot of NXT acts, when they get called down to the main roster, they screwed it all up. But that was the match that made me sit up and take notice of how great this guy really was in the ring. His problem was that he could not speak good enough English to satisfy his boss. And to be fair, his promos do need a lot of work. It has been his Achilles heel on the main roster. He cannot cut promos on his own. But that is why it was so mind-bogglingly stupid to split him away from Zelina Vega. There was absolutely no good reason. Even if Zelina wanted to wrestle more, even if they wanted to do more with her, you could do more with her without breaking them up as an act. Promos were still this man's weakness. There was absolutely no good reason to break the two of them up. Aside from the fact that maybe they looked at Zelina and said, hey, we can do more with her. She's the real star here. This guy over here, we don't really see much in him. You can kind of tell. You don't need some dirt sheet or backstage source to tell you. You watch these shows over a period of weeks and months, and you get a very good sense of who the priorities are and who the people are that they don't really value as much. And clearly, they didn't really value Andrade. He fell out of favor. So he requested his release, and the word is that his request has been denied by Vince McMahon. They are not going to let him go. My advice to Andrade, if he really wants out of this company that badly, it's very simple. Just follow his former manager's lead. And just start a Twitch. Just start up a Twitch channel. Start playing Warzone or fucking Super Mario or whatever. You can do anything you want. Go ahead and start a Twitch. Open a Twitch. Open a Cameo page. Easiest way to get fired. The man has been consistently unhappy in this company going back to the early reports from when he was still in NXT and he was struggling. This is before he won the NXT championship. He was a very unhappy person down there. And he thought about leaving, and then things turned around for him. His main roster run, like so many NXT stars before him, has been a complete and utter disappointment. And it is yet another example of a talented wrestler not being utilized properly and being wasted being wasted, wasting away his prime years working for somebody who doesn't get him, who doesn't really see anything in him. He's not happy, and you know what? He has every right to be unhappy. Instead of holding the man hostage, if you really don't have any plans for him, if you really don't value what he brings to the table, you don't get it, you don't see it in him, then let him go be happy somewhere else. According to Meltzer, Andrade was the key person who dissuaded Roosh and Dragon Lee from signing with WWE when they were free agents and they were thinking about, okay, where are we going to go next? And ultimately, they decided to not come to WWE. I'm sure WWE would have had interest in them. And he was the key force dissuading them, telling them, no, 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 you don't want to do that. You're making a big mistake. You want to stay far away from this place. Because he's a good friend. And that's what a good friend does. They give you a heads up. He is smart enough to know exactly what would happen to those two if they ever did sign with this company. Welcome the two newest members of the Lucha House Party. Roosh and Dragon Lee. It's very clear to me that Vince McMahon has absolutely no plans for this guy. Just like I remember reading something a few weeks ago. Oh, Aleister Black. WWE, you know, they've got big plans for Aleister Black. They're just biding their time and they're waiting. Let's come back to this in 6 months and see if they're still waiting. They have no plans for this man. The moment that he realized this guy could not speak English all that well, or well enough to cut promos for himself on TV once he lost his manager, he was dead. That was it. He was dead in the water. It is a death knell for you in this company if you cannot speak good English on television. Unless your name is Asuka, and she can get away with it because they have her act all goofy on TV, and they like that. They like Goofy. Goofy is their favorite Disney character. Dopey is the Disney character that best describes some of the people who work behind the scenes in this company. Grumpy describes Andrade, and Vince McMahon fired Sneezy a long time ago for obvious reasons. But, you know, a few months ago, wasn't that long ago, he was off television already. I remember Andrade tweeting out a photo, maybe more than one, but he tweeted out a photo with no context or subtitle or anything, of him wearing the NXT championship from that run that he had as the champion in NXT. So it is possible that he wanted to, he was open to the idea, maybe even pitched it, of going back to NXT. Maybe he made the request, and maybe he was turned down. I think the same thing happened with Aleister Black. Another wasted talent. But I look at this guy, and you know, there are people who will look at Andrade and say, oh, well, you know, WWE is not wrong. There's nothing really special about the guy. He's a decent wrestler, but he brings nothing else to the table. I've seen that criticism written about as well. Or he can't talk, he can't cut promos, right? Which we've already talked about. I look at this guy, and what I see is a man who got over in Mexico. I see a man who got over in Japan. Both places under a mask, too. So we're not talking about some guy who's getting over on his facial expressions and stuff. This was under a mask as a luchador. In Mexico, he got over. He was considered one of the best in the world. He went to Japan and had matches over there and was considered one of the best in the world. He was a champion. And it took him a while once he came and he signed with NXT, because remember, the early part of his run, it took him a while to find himself. You know, the whole El Idolo thing with Zelina Vega, that didn't come right away. When he first debuted, I think he was a babyface, and he was coming out looking like a Chippendales dancer. He had the suspenders, he had that stupid hat. He looked ridiculous. Nobody coming out dressed like that is going to get over. But he ended up getting over in NXT as well. Took a little bit longer, but he did it. He ended up getting over there too. So every place that he was, up until he hit the main roster, he had no problem getting over and letting his work speak for itself. So he has proven that he can get over in different places. The one place that he didn't make it is the one place that they didn't know how to play to his strengths, and hide his weaknesses. I would love to see Andrade take his talents to New Japan. I think that would be a great landing spot for him. Although he may want to stay stateside given that he's engaged to Charlotte. I think that would be tough. And then there is AEW. And I know, yes, it would be another WWE star coming to AEW. But the thing that is appealing to me is the fact that Zelina Vega is also a free agent right now. Her non-compete window should be up. If Andrade can wiggle his way free or just wait it out, I have no idea how much time he has left on his contract. It could be a few months. It could be 2 years. I think that's the problem that Aleister Black is in. I think the guy has years left on his deal with no indication the company wants to let him go. But if he could somehow wiggle his way free, Tony Khan, I think, would be crazy not to make the pitch to bring both of them in and put them back together and reunite them. I think they play off each other very well. Ring of Honor, I think, could also be a likely destination. He's got friends there. The same friends he said, don't come to WWE, stay right where you are. So we know that he's got friends who work there. But if the man is unhappy and you're not doing anything with him and you see no value in him, then let him go. Let him walk. You are so stockpiled with talent right now that you don't even know what to do with 60 to 70% of them. They're just there. You just want to sign everybody up. Here you have somebody that you clearly aren't doing anything with. Let the man go. But they won't. Not because they see any value in him, but because they don't want him going somewhere else. And if he does go somewhere else and he finds success, it will make the company look bad that they had this man under contract and they couldn't figure out what to do with him. Even if you drew them a fucking map, they could not figure out a way to do something with this man. And so, unfortunately for him, I think he's going to be unhappy for a very long time. Now, he's still a relatively young guy. I think he's in his early 30s. You know, but again, these are your prime years, physically, your prime years, your prime earning years. And I can understand the frustration. And for his sake, look, maybe they'll have a change of heart at some point. But as of right now, it doesn't look like he's going anywhere. And Big Johnny is back in the saddle. People power. John Laurinaitis, he's back, and he never really left. I mean, he's been working behind the scenes, I think, as a producer for years. But John Laurinaitis, back in charge of talent relations in WWE. His official title is said to be General Manager of Talent. The department has been split into two divisions. One for talent management, which is what he will oversee. The other for talent branding, which I assume will be run by somebody else who will be responsible for booking talent for outside appearances and commercials and movies and other third-party engagements. Laurinaitis previously was the head of talent relations. He took over from Jim Ross in 2004. He was in that role, I think, until 2012, I want to say. Mark Carano, who replaced him, will now report to him and will have the great pleasure of being the hatchet man who gets to deliver all the bad news to talent. Per the Observer, Laurinaitis always has a smile on his face for Vince McMahon, and he doesn't challenge him on anything. So this is a case of Vince just going with the proverbial yes man, who he can install and will simply just answer to him and do whatever he's told. Yes, sir. Sounds exactly like what this company needs more of. And Jim Johnston, that's a name I know many of you are familiar with. Jim Johnston spent 32 years on a handshake deal working for Vince McMahon and WWE as their music composer. And in 2017, that 32-year run came to an end by their decision, not his. He was the music guru for basically the entire length of my fandom. All the major eras, the Golden Age when he first came in, the New Generation era, the Attitude Era, Ruthless Aggression, was responsible for some of the most iconic themes in wrestling history. He gave an interview to Lucha Libre Online and had this to say about the current era of entrance music in WWE. said, while I told you before this interview that I don't do trash talking, the closest I'll get to being critical is that, absolutely, I want to slap Vince upside the head. The music is so bad. These days, it's just sound effects and noises and stuff. It doesn't have anything to do with the characters and the storylines anymore. That is the essence of this business, and that is currently lost. I don't get it. I hate to say this, but there's a certain satisfaction that the music now is so bad because it makes me feel better about what I contributed. It does make me feel bad for a bunch of the wrestlers, because without good music, you cannot become a big star. I don't believe it is possible. The music is just like a score in a movie. It's what leads the fans' emotions. It is a very visceral, very deeply emotional connection. That's always what I went for, and now that is what is missing. To be fair, Jim Johnston was not exactly knocking it out of the park his last few years either. And CFOs were not terrible. They did crank out some really good themes for, you know, Shinsuke Nakamura. That probably was their best one. Bobby Roode, Finn Balor, Sasha Banks, Asuka. And now we don't even have that in some cases. I mean, they still use some of the songs, but in other cases, we don't even have that because there's some rights issues that are involved, I think, with the publisher. I think WWE only owned about 50% of all of CFO's songs, and so they have started phasing a lot of those songs out or tweaking them in some way. You know, hence the issue with Keith Lee's old music. He had to go and have new music recorded. CFOs is not even together anymore. The band members, they disbanded last year, so there is no CFOs anymore anyway. But now, this is not to say that everything that Jim Johnston has produced over the years has been gold, because it hasn't. You know, even towards the end, it was not his best stuff. But I would argue that his best work is absolutely iconic. If you are a wrestling fan, if you are a WWE fan, his best work is absolutely just iconic stuff. And he is totally 100% right about the importance of having good entrance music. It can make or break a character. You know, and I'll give you an example. This goes back to CFOs. Samoa Joe. When Samoa Joe first walked out and debuted on NXT television, about probably 6 years ago now, I think it was. If you remember, when he first walked out on TV, when they hit the first chords of his music, it sounded great, and then it transitioned into the main part of the song, and I laughed hysterically, because it totally did not fit this man's character, it did not fit this man's demeanor at all. It's like, where did that come from? Maybe they didn't have a lot of time to put that music together. It was like a temporary placeholder because they weren't aware of his debut until the day before. That's the only thing I could think of. But if he had kept that music, it would have killed him. Every time he walked out, now Joe was good enough, he probably could have overcome it. But my God, if he had kept that music as is, it would have absolutely killed him. It would have made his job that much harder. Once they tweaked it, it made a world of difference. And I like Samoa Joe's theme. I think it's one of the better CFO's themes. But the new theme music in general today in WWE, it's just not very good. I don't want to make a blanket statement and say that it's all garbage, it's all crap. It's not all crap. A lot of it is crap. But like the Hurt Business may be one of the lone exceptions. But absolutely, WWE just needs a massive overhaul when it comes to their music. And I don't think anybody who is listening to this right now, whether you agree with me on Johnston and CFOs or not, put that aside, we could all agree on one thing, and that is the importance of having a good entrance theme. It cannot be overstated. It is very important. It can absolutely help determine who gets over and who doesn't. And that has been a big problem for WWE in the last few years, especially after Johnston left. And it's still a problem I think they're dealing with today. The music just is not as good as it used to be. Now, Raw from Monday night. We had another Monday night, another abysmal show outside of a couple of segments. The Miz got a rematch for the WWE title against Bobby Lashley. And not only that, he got a rematch. It went 9 minutes long. But it was mostly a 9-minute squash. So I'll allow it. But why would a man who literally ran away, he ran for his life, intentionally got himself counted out on television the week before, why would this man be granted a rematch for the championship? Drew McIntyre is still waiting for his rematch. He didn't get one. He didn't get one, but The Miz does. Bobby Lashley's new entrance video is outstanding. It screams superstar when he walks out now. So between the Hurt Business music, which I like, and now this big elaborate entrance video they put together, the almighty, I think it just looks fantastic. Sheamus and Drew McIntyre beat the hell out of each other. They had a no disqualification match, ended with a ref stoppage. Both men had hoisted up a piece of the ring steps, and they bonked each other in the head with them at the same time. Drew took this hilariously ridiculous bump over the barricade. Sheamus just laid there dead while referees checked on both guys, and they called the match off. It was more good stuff from these two, which looks to be building to a gimmick match at the Fastlane pay-per-view next Sunday. We'll have to get some kind of announcement on TV tomorrow night, because we're going to be 6 days out from Fastlane. So I look at this as probably ending up as, you know, last man standing or some type of stipulation like that, with the winner then going on to challenge Lashley for the championship at WrestleMania. And that's how Drew gets in, and that's how Drew gets his match with Bobby Lashley. Because you see, Drew ain't The Miz. The Miz can just command a rematch. Drew McIntyre has to fight for it. He's got to earn it. Matt Riddle got a win over Slapdick. Another loss for Retribution, while their leader, Ali, gets to challenge for the United States Championship on Raw tomorrow night. At least we'll get a good match out of it. But I would not put a gold watch on anybody in that faction right now, let alone a title. Shane McMahon, oh boy. Oh boy. Let me talk about this. I already put a tweet out about this, but you can only say so much in a tweet. I mean, 230 or whatever, 240 characters, you just can't do it. Can't do it justice. That Shane McMahon segment, there were multiple ones, but I'm talking about the main one with him and Braun Strowman from Monday night, was one of, and I'm not exaggerating when I say this, I've seen every episode of Monday Night Raw. So I am as much an authority on this as anybody else who has seen every episode of Monday Night Raw since 1993. And I can sit here and tell you, this will go down among the all-time worst segments that I have ever seen on Monday Night Raw. Not the most offensive, but one of the worst. Nothing happened. Nothing. Absolutely nothing happened. Everything that is wrong with these three-hour shows where they just blather on and they're clearly just stalling for time because they have no good ideas. We just have to kill TV time. So we'll put two guys out there. They'll meander on about absolutely nothing, and then we'll get to cut to commercial. We just got to get to the next set. Let's just get to seg 8 or seg 14. We just got to get to the next one. That's what this felt like. They have an army of writers in this company. Now, they have one showrunner, we know that, but they have an army of writers that work for them and get paid to do this for a living. And this is the best that they could come up with. Braun Strowman was in the ring. He was waiting for an apology from Shane McMahon because he's a big softy. He wants an apology. Or he's expecting an apology. Shane McMahon, he pretends first that his microphone doesn't work. And he leaves the ring to grab a new microphone so he can put some distance between himself and Braun. His microphone was fine. He just wanted to put some distance between him and the big man. He proceeds as he is walking up the aisleway. He's going to cut his promo in the aisle. He proceeds to breathe heavily into the microphone as he stalls to see what he wants to say next. Here, let me do my best Shane McMahon impression here in 2021. This is not the old Shane McMahon. This is the current version of Shane McMahon. Let me do my best Shane McMahon impersonation. You know what that sounds like when I go to the doctor and he has the stethoscope and he tells me to breathe in and breathe out? Shane McMahon, it feels like he thinks he's in a doctor's office every time he's cutting a promo and has a microphone in his hand. I don't think he actually forgot. Some people thought he forgot his lines. I don't think he forgot anything. I don't think he forgot his lines. I think this went exactly the way they wrote it. He was trying to frustrate Braun Strowman. Braun is waiting for him to say something. He's waiting for his apology. And Shane just can't get it out. He said nothing. His labored breathing would worry any doctor who was watching this show. He said he didn't want to call Braun stupid, which he ended up doing anyway at the end of this because he's the heel in this. Braun eventually chased after him to the back. That is literally all that happened in this segment. If I am fortunate enough to live to a ripe old age, and I am sitting here at home, all shriveled up, like a raisin in my final days, recording Sound Off episode 2798. Looking back on my life and how I spent my time, I'm going to remember this Shane McMahon segment and regret the fact that I wasted those minutes of my life that I would give anything to have back. This sucked, and it did absolutely nothing to get anybody interested in seeing Braun Strowman against Shane McMahon at WrestleMania. We know Shane is going to fall from a high place, the fucking pirate ship in the back of the stadium or something. We know this. It's what he does. It's the same thing that they built to that big spot with him and The Miz at WrestleMania 35? I'm watching this guy and I'm listening to him and the breathing and the profuse sweating in a lot of his promos. And I'm not even sure how this guy gets cleared for physical contact. How does he get cleared to wrestle? They have taken other guys who are in far better physical shape than he is, and they would tell them you can't even look at Christian. Christian had to go sign with another company. Christian, when he came back last year to have that segment with Randy Orton, you know, he talked about this on Renee Paquette's podcast this past week. They wouldn't even let him, anybody could touch him physically. It was off limits. How does Shane McMahon get cleared to do anything? the sweating, the breathing. I guarantee you that that person, if that was a wrestler, that person would not be cleared to compete. Dr. Maroon in Pittsburgh would say, no way, you're not doing this. We're keeping you out. Every time I see this guy on TV, he looks like he's four steps away from a pacemaker. I'm begging the medical staff there, please give this man a stress test and an echocardiogram, please. By the way, we are now 4 weeks away from back-to-back nights of WrestleMania. Shane McMahon, it's not official, but clearly Shane McMahon is going to have a match on that show. And AJ Styles has no match. Now, if Triple H is going to wrestle, and every week that goes by, it looks less likely, but we still have a month, so they could still put something together. There's still time. I still expect that if Triple H does wrestle, if he does have a match on this show, that AJ is probably going to be the opponent. It's a match that's never been done before. AJ has openly talked about the fact that he wants to have that match at some point. But if not, if he's not going to wrestle, how is it that one of the best guys that you have on your roster is totally directionless right now? You know, I was looking at the Raw roster to see, because I'll get the inevitable question, well, Solomonster, if you feel that way, then who would you put him in the ring with? And so I took a look at the Raw roster to just remind myself of exactly who's being used and who's on the roster that's not being used. I just talked about one of those guys a little while ago. I looked up and down that roster, and there aren't very many good options, but honestly, if they had not buried Ricochet as a complete geek for so long, AJ Styles against Ricochet, which they've already done a couple of times on TV, but let's say they hadn't, or again, Ricochet was not a complete geek, AJ Styles one-on-one at WrestleMania against Ricochet would have been a fantastic opener, I think, on night one of WrestleMania. You know, AJ's been in the opener before. He had an opening match with Shane McMahon, funny enough, at WrestleMania 33, and it was one of the best matches on the entire WrestleMania show. So AJ and Ricochet could have been an option. Now it's just laughable to even think about. If Keith Lee wasn't hurt, and I do believe that's why Keith Lee has not been on TV. I believe he is out with some sort of injury. I don't know how serious it is. I think Keith Lee and AJ Styles one-on-one could have been another great option. But it is just amazing to me that we are here talking about Shane McMahon and his labored breathing going into WrestleMania, and yet AJ Styles is a man with no match. They finally got the match over with for the women's tag team titles with Naomi and Lana challenging Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler. It's been on the back burner for a while, and then somebody in the company realized, oh, we forgot to do this match, so let's just get this over with. Jax and Baszler retained. And Reginald is now not only making appearances on SmackDown, but we have to see him on Raw too. Nia Jax felt bad for him after he was fired by Carmella, and she thinks he's cute, and so she's keeping him around. He is her new boy toy. And because the women's tag team champions can appear across brands, Reginald gets to come with them. He's part of the package now, at least for the next few weeks. So he got bumped at some point during this match, and Nia Jax, after they won, she ended up carrying him over her shoulder to the back. You know, it's bad enough that they are ruining the build to Sasha Banks against Bianca Belair at WrestleMania by including this man, inserting him into the mix. Now we have to watch him on Raw too. And we had a Randy Orton AJ Styles main event, where Randy Orton was getting ready for an RKO when Alexa Bliss appeared on the big screen. She had a Jack in the Box, but before it was going to spring open, she stopped it and said, not now, or she said, not yet, I think it was. She lit a match. She blew out the match. And Randy Orton again begins coughing up black goo, which allowed AJ to hit a phenomenal forearm for the win. Dreadful. Dreadful garbage. I am Randy Orton, and the black goo on Monday night that we saw coming from his mouth, the black goo represents Monday Night Raw. Never has there been a more accurate visual. I am so done with this. Let's just get to the Firefly Funhouse match. Let's get this over with, and let's move on. It is not a reflection. It's not even a reflection on Randy Orton. It's not a reflection on Alexa Bliss. Like, if you're an Alexa Bliss fan, and there are a lot of them out there, there's a lot of Bliss bots and Bliss fans out there, just like a lot of the other women on the roster have these very loyal, dedicated fans. I don't even see how an Alexa Bliss fan at this point could be completely satisfied with how she's being used on TV. She just pops up in these random segments and doesn't really do anything else. How come they're not more upset about the way that she's being used? I just don't see what's appealing about any of this. I really don't. I can appreciate the fact that they burned a man to a crisp on live television, and they have kept him off television for a while. At least they didn't put him back on TV 2 weeks later. I can appreciate that. But my God, when are we supposed to see this guy again? What is going on here every week with the black goo? Enough! One thing that did not air on Raw, and it would not have saved the show, but it would have been nice to see a promo like this on the actual television show instead of whatever the fuck it was that we got with the Shane-O heart attack, was an impassioned promo from Peyton Royce on Raw Talk, who vented her frustrations about her spot in the women's division. This is what she said. Asuka is injured right now, and yes, that sucks for her. But when a talent goes down, a spot opens up, and that spot is massive. So, why not me? Why does it always have to be the same old, same old? You know, I packed up my life, I moved across the world, I set up in a completely different country with not much of a support system to chase this dream. To do what? To sit in the locker room and watch women do what I do better than 98% of them? And the other 2%, well, I'd sure as hell give them a run for their money. It actually hurts when you know how deep in your soul you are destined to be where you are, striving for what you feel you deserve. my potential haunts me. When you're striving for something you feel you really deserve, this is where I am meant to be, and my patience has been running thin for quite some time. Stop wasting my time and give me Asuka. It's a very good promo. And she is right. Asuka is said to have a concussion from that errant kick to the face by Shayna Baszler a few weeks ago. And her status for WrestleMania is currently unknown. That's the tricky thing with these concussions. We've seen this before. You can have a concussion and be back in a week or two. You can have a concussion and have to forfeit your championship. That's what happened to Dolph Ziggler when he won the World Heavyweight title all those years ago. I remember Jack Swagger, I think, kicked him in the head. And I think Ziggler was out for quite a while, actually. And it just ruined whatever kind of run he would have had. It really did ruin the whole thing. So they're very tricky. And it's tough because now we're a few weeks away from WrestleMania. You can't really wait until a week before. I mean, she's got some time left, but you got to make a move. When you're this close to WrestleMania, you have your women's champion who looks like she may not be able to go. WWE has a decision to make. Her status for WrestleMania is up in the air. Time is running out. I would give it another week. And if Asuka is still not cleared, strip her of the title. That title needs to be defended at WrestleMania. And when Asuka is ready to come back, she can claim to be the uncrowned champion who was never beaten. Peyton Royce wants an opportunity? I say give it to her. Give it to her in a women's battle royal. On the Raw after Fastlane. Or if they don't want to give Asuka another week, then they can just strip her this week. And they can make the battle royal for the pay-per-view next Sunday. You have Peyton Royce, Charlotte Flair, Alexa Bliss, Dana Brooke, Mandy Rose, Lana, Naomi, Shayna Baszler, Nia Jax, and the debuting Rhea Ripley. They keep saying, she's coming, she's coming. Well, she's here. Rhea Ripley debuts. And the final two women left standing face off at WrestleMania for the vacant Raw Women's Championship. And those two women, predictable as it may be, you don't exactly have a great selection there, but it's the right call to make. The final two women standing in the Battle Royal are Charlotte Flair and Rhea Ripley. With Rhea going on to WrestleMania to avenge her loss at last year's show to Charlotte. With a title win in Raymond James Stadium. That is how you make a star. That is how you come back to that story and you give that story a proper ending. You give Rhea Ripley proper closure for what happened last year and the year that she had in 2020. That is how you, right out of the gate, from the moment she debuts, you establish her as a force to be reckoned with on this show in a division that desperately needs her help. That is how you do it. And now, Rhea has a ready-made program or a pay-per-view defense at some point, ready to go with Asuka whenever Asuka is cleared to come back. You do Asuka and Rhea, which is something we've never seen before, and I think could be quite good. Now, let's say that Asuka is cleared this week. She shows up to TV tomorrow, and they evaluate her, and they give her a clean bill of health, and Asuka is ready to come back on TV and to work. You can do the match one-on-one, Asuka against Charlotte, which seemed to be the direction anyway, at WrestleMania. Have Asuka beat her. Charlotte already beat her at WrestleMania 34. WrestleMania 37 tells a different story. Asuka gets a win over Charlotte Flair. Rhea Ripley can then debut on television the very next night, and you can set things in motion there. The only difference now is that Asuka's the champion, and Rhea is going to be the one challenging. But you still get to the same destination. This is not hard to do. It took me 5 minutes to come up with this. This is not difficult. We know what Rhea can do. She has already appeared on the main roster. She is not a mystery to people. She was one of the last two people in the Women's Royal Rumble match. Do not pussyfoot around with this woman. This division is dying. It needs help. It is sick. Peyton is right. With injury comes opportunity, but not for Peyton Royce. Not yet. It's an opportunity to establish Rhea Ripley as a dominant force in that Raw women's division. I'm all for Peyton Royce getting her opportunity at some point. Now is not the right time. You're heading into the biggest show of the year. Now is not the time to shoehorn Peyton Royce into a championship match at WrestleMania. The time now is to get Rhea Ripley established as the person. Right up there, right alongside Asuka and Charlotte. Top three, right there, in your Raw women's division. That is the way to go. Let's talk about fairness. You know it's not fair. The fact that Netflix hides thousands of shows from you based on your location, and then they have the nerve to turn around and increase their prices. That's right. Starting at the end of this month, they're raising prices once again. Now, you could just cancel your subscription in protest, or you can be smart about it and make sure you're getting your full money's worth by using ExpressVPN like I do. See, you might not know that what's on Netflix in your country is completely different from what somebody in the UK or Japan has on theirs. Using ExpressVPN, I can control which country I want Netflix to think that I'm in. ExpressVPN has over 90 countries to choose from, so every time I run out of stuff to watch, I just switch to another country and unlock new shows. Right now, I'm watching Modern Family. It's not on US Netflix, but with just one tap of a button, ExpressVPN lets me change my location to Singapore so that I can watch it. And here's the best part. It's not just for Netflix. You can use ExpressVPN to unlock shows on other streaming services too. I've used it to watch BBC iPlayer. It's free and only available in the UK. ExpressVPN is also super fast and works on your phone, laptop, even smart TVs. So you can watch your shows on the big screen with zero buffering. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/Solomonster. Don't forget to use my link so that you can get 3 extra months free. That's expressvpn.com/Solomonster. expressvpn.com/Solomonster to learn more. SmackDown on Friday night sure did make it seem like we're heading for a triple threat at WrestleMania for the Universal title. Edge, in storyline, is upset with the way that Daniel Bryan has muscled his way into the title picture. And it doesn't really make any sense to me why Edge is so upset with Bryan over any of this, or why he thinks that Bryan is being so selfish. Edge has a guaranteed title shot at WrestleMania, and being in the main event, challenging for the championship by virtue of winning the Royal Rumble match. That is set in stone. It is guaranteed. It does not matter who the champion is. Edge is going to get his shot whether it's Daniel Bryan or whether it's Roman Reigns. So why is he so upset? Why is he so emotional over this? Now, if this were to turn into a triple threat match, then I can understand. That would make more sense. See, I think they jumped the gun on this. I think you could have had weeks of television with Bryan and Edge being very coy and very polite, but like in a way where you can kind of tell that one guy doesn't either like the other or doesn't trust the other one. And then all roads lead to Fastlane, which is where they're going and the whole guest enforcer thing, which I'll get into here in a second. But then coming out of that, if the plan is to do a triple threat, then you can have Edge come out on television and be very upset and say, you know, when I won the Royal Rumble at WrestleMania, I was under the assumption that I was the one getting a Universal title match one-on-one. Now I've got to contend with another person in the match, and you're trying to take my dream away from me. And then Bryan can go into his dream and how he thinks this could potentially be his last WrestleMania, which it won't be. And that would make so much more sense. I almost feel like they just jumped the gun by a few weeks on this, because Edge just looks, he just looks moody. It's like, what are you so upset about, bro? You're getting a title shot, bro. You got nothing to be upset about. So Nia Jax, I mentioned during the Raw review, you know, she's got a thing for Reginald. Carmella's now unemployed champagne connoisseur. So she took him suit shopping, while Shayna Baszler tagged along and looked completely bored and completely disinterested. Her reactions were really the only thing that saved any of this. I was more entertained by that than anything else. And look, I don't have an issue with Reginald being used for comedy. If that's what they want to do, he should have absolutely nothing to do with the Sasha Banks, Bianca Belair stuff. It kind of reminds me, you know, on a smaller scale, obviously, but it reminds me in a way of WWE involving Deborah in the initial build to the Stone Cold Rock match at WrestleMania 17, which they thankfully dropped pretty quickly. I mean, the whole Deborah's involvement was really only limited to maybe a couple of weeks, and then I don't think she was ever mentioned again, and she wasn't out there for the match at Mania. It could have been a lot worse. But it was like, why are you involving her in this? She has nothing to do with this. This does not need Deborah. You've got a match between two of the biggest stars in the history of the business. The match sells itself, which it did. In the end, that's exactly what happened. But that's kind of what this reminds me of. It's completely unnecessary. It adds nothing to the program. Keep him out of this. Nobody asked for him to be involved. All it does is detract from what should be one of the feature matches at WrestleMania. And to make matters worse, they had a match on this show pitting Sasha and Bianca, who are getting a tag team title match again next Sunday at Fastlane. They already got one, now they're getting another one. They had a match with Sasha and Bianca against Tamina and Natalya, and they had Tamina pin Bianca Belair off of a distraction finish involving Sasha and Reggie. Tamina pinned the winner of the Women's Royal Rumble match 4 weeks before WrestleMania. Tamina. There are no words. No words for that. Actually, I can think of a few. I can think of a few four-letter words that I threw around when I saw that finish, but I'll leave that up to your imagination. Big E. Let's cleanse the palate here. Because there was stuff I really liked. This is one of them. Big E, back on TV for the first time in many weeks since Apollo Crews injured him with the ring steps. I loved the fire that he showed here in this promo. He said there's no coming back for Apollo. Now he has to go biblical on him. He needs to go Old Testament on him because it's eye for an eye. He said Crews came to hurt him, so now he's out to maim him. He was ready to give him what he wants right then and there. He was going to put the Intercontinental title on the line right there on Friday night. I thought this was pitch perfect. Exactly how he had to come back. No smiling and silly jokes. I mean, he came out wearing a neck brace and a cast and all these things that he was ripping off of him as he came down to the ring. I thought that was kind of dumb. But once he got in the ring and had a mic in his hand, it's exactly the way that Big E had to return. This guy tried to end his career. Can't have him coming back on TV as New Day Big E, just cutting jokes and trying to be silly and fun. Playtime's over. The time for jokes and games is over. Now, after what Apollo did to this guy, it's time to get serious. It's time to knuckle up and get serious. And that's what Big E did on television on Friday night. Just anger and rage. Now, when Apollo didn't come out, Big E said, well, I'm going to just throw an open challenge out. First person who comes out, you get a match with me for the Intercontinental Championship. And Baron Corbin came out to accept, and he was blathering on about something. Instead of coming right out and saying, I accept, Sami Zayn then came out with his documentary crew and said, I accept. He says, I beat you to the punch. And Big E said, I'll tell you what, first guy who gets into the ring is going to get the match. And Sami slid into the ring, and it was Sami Zayn one-on-one against Big E. Big E won. And when the match was over, Apollo Crews attacked him from behind. I thought this was a very aggressive attack. I thought this was very good. Left him laying again with a shot from the ring steps. And it ended with him standing on the ring steps like he was winning a gold medal. He was standing on the ring steps in the middle of the ring. I love this new Apollo Crews, the new and improved Apollo Crews. Everything with this is firing right now. For a mid-card, you know, Intercontinental title feud heading into WrestleMania season, I think this is great. You know, we've actually had more of a focus on the Intercontinental Championship in recent years. I go back to WrestleMania 34. They opened the show with a great triple threat match for the IC title. I think it was Miz, Rollins, and Balor. That was an excellent match. I'm pretty sure the title was defended each of the last 2 years of WrestleMania. I know last year it was Sammy and Daniel Bryan, and then Sammy, because of the pandemic, he disappeared and went home. 35, I'm trying to remember what the IC title, I don't remember offhand, but I'm almost positive it was defended. But it's noteworthy because there was a period of many, many years where the championship wasn't even defended. I guess it goes back even further, though. You go back to the ladder match they had at WrestleMania 32, when Zack Ryder won for 24 hours. He got to be the champion. But there was a period of many years where the title was completely neglected. So even though it's been defended now for many years on the Mania card, I still have memories of this title just being completely discarded as nothing special at all. So when we have a solid, you know, mid-card program for the title heading into WrestleMania, it's nice to see. The title should always be defended at WrestleMania. You've got two nights of WrestleMania. If you can't find time for your U.S. title and your Intercontinental title, then what's the point of even having them? And I can't say that there's anything great going on with the U.S. title right now, but on SmackDown with the IC, I'm digging this. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe they don't do a title change at Fastlane. Maybe they do, because I'm sure they're going to have Big E and Apollo next Sunday. Although, well, let's see. Let's think about this. We're a week out. By the time we get to SmackDown on Friday, we're only going to be 48 hours away. Now, it's possible they can make an announcement on Twitter or on their website during the week and make a title match for Fastlane, and you know, they'll do some kind of contract signing or something with them on Friday. But as of this moment, we're a week out and there is no title match, so maybe they won't do one. But I would be very surprised if they don't do something with Big E and Apollo next Sunday. I don't think you need to do a title change there. I think if they do the match, it could be like a DQ finish or something that then leads to a championship match at WrestleMania. And when they go to WrestleMania, I think Apollo Crews becomes the Intercontinental Champion, because after all of his previous losses, remember, he had a whole bunch of opportunities and he blew them all. And that's kind of, in storyline, that's kind of what triggered this whole change in attitude. If he goes on to challenge again for the championship and just straight up loses, then it does no favors to this new character that he is trying to build. I don't want to say he's dead in the water, but it certainly won't do this new heel character any favors if he changes his entire attitude and still comes out a loser. I think he has to. I think he has to win. And then you can have Big E chase for it. But I would save the title change for WrestleMania. I wouldn't do it next Sunday. And during the week, some of you may have missed this, WWE posted a photo on Instagram from SmackDown last week of Murphy confronting Seth Rollins in that backstage segment a week ago, where Rollins just wouldn't even make eye contact with him. Murphy came up to him. He was offering his services to take out Cesaro, and Rollins basically just said, "Get out of my face. I don't want to see you. I don't want to hear from you." And Murphy walked away. So they had a picture of the two of them backstage from that segment. By the way, thus undoing months of storylines. So they put the picture up. Murphy, who was said to have been very frustrated behind the scenes because all of a sudden he was on TV all the time and now he hasn't been on television in weeks and weeks. It's like they just dropped the whole thing with him and his babyface turn and the Mysterio family. He disappeared. He posted a reply underneath the photo, which he quickly deleted shortly thereafter, but you know, the internet never forgets. He offered this storyline explanation for why he and Aaliyah Mysterio are no longer together. "Let's point out the obvious. The Mysterios used me. I never needed them. I am beyond one of the most talented in-ring performers on the planet. Aaliyah used me to be on TV and advance her acting career. Dominic used me so that he had a reason to stand ringside. Ray was jealous that I became the new face of the Cruiserweights, and he was left out of the discussion. They took what they wanted, and then they left me in the shadows. Sounds like my time in NXT. Well, there you have it. The legendary Rey Mysterio felt threatened by Murphy's status as a cruiserweight legend on 205 Live. And look, hey, maybe this would have meant something had they followed up on that with a Murphy promo on TV Friday night, but that promo never came. Now, he did delete it right away, so either he realized how dumb he sounded, or he posted it totally on his own just to try to make sense of something that makes no sense, and somebody in management told him to take it down. That's also a possibility. He did wrestle Cesaro. He was on TV Friday night. He did have a match against Cesaro, which ended when Seth Rollins interfered and attacked Cesaro, and Murphy just sort of faded into the abyss, never to be seen again. Which is a pretty spot-on description of his career path. The show ended with Daniel Bryan and Roman Reigns sitting down, signing the contract for their championship match next Sunday. From Fastlane 6 years ago to Fastlane this year, we have come full circle with these two. I think that was their very first singles match, or at least on pay-per-view. It was Fastlane back in 2015, and here we are in Fastlane 2021, and these two are getting ready to go one-on-one once again. Jey Uso did not take kindly to some of the things that Bryan was saying, and so he demanded that Adam Pearce make him the special guest enforcer for the match at Fastlane, which brought Edge out, and Edge thought that was a fabulous idea, but instead he pitched a match for SmackDown this Friday night between Edge and Jey Uso, and the winner of that match will then become the enforcer. Pearce liked that idea. A brawl broke out with Edge going after Roman Reigns, and Daniel Bryan disposed of Jey Uso, and when Bryan went to go after Roman, Edge shoved him out of the way. And Bryan took out Edge with a running knee to end the show. If the start of the show did not convince you that we're getting a triple threat match at WrestleMania, then I think the ending sure did. And if they do it, what that tells me is that Roman Reigns is probably going to be dropping the Universal title at WrestleMania without being pinned. This could be their way of protecting him, and he loses the title without actually being beaten for it. I think Daniel Bryan is being inserted into this match to take the losing fall. I think Edge is going to pin him, and Edge is going to walk out as the champion, which I don't like. But that's how it feels to me. I would not take the title off of Roman Reigns. This Friday night, Edge wrestles Jey Uso, and the winner will become the enforcer for the main event next Sunday. And we're also getting a women's championship match between Sasha Banks and Nia Jax, which means more hijinks with Reginald. Oh joy! I can hardly contain my excitement. Let's talk about AEW here for a little bit. Last night, Impact Wrestling held its Sacrifice pay-per-view. Rich Swann beat Moose in a champion-against-champion title-for-title main event to unify the Impact and TNA World Heavyweight titles, which means Rich Swann is now going to go on to defend his championship, his newly unified title, in the main event of the Impact Rebellion pay-per-view April 24th against the AEW World Champion Kenny Omega. That is not going to be unification, but it is going to be champion-against-champion winner-take-all. So somebody is walking out with all the gold at the end of that pay-per-view next month. Moose has had some pretty impressive showing so far this year. You know, he stepped in first to replace Alex Shelley at the Hard to Kill pay-per-view in January when Shelley could not travel to, I guess, Nashville for the six-man tag team main event. So Moose took his place, and Moose was probably the most impressive person in that entire match. The match with Swann last night, I watched it a little bit earlier, and he was also very impressive in that match. Kenny Omega has to beat Rich Swann. AEW, Tony Khan, they would be fools. Fools! To send Kenny Omega to an Impact pay-per-view, and after as protected as Omega has been since winning the title from Jon Moxley, to send him over there and have Rich Swann beat him, it's laughable for me to even think about. Absolutely laughable. So either we're going to get some kind of fuck finish, which would be dumb because you're promising people winner take all, then people are just going to feel cheated. So they've kind of put themselves in a corner where we have to have a winner, and the only winner that is the only logical option is Kenny Omega. So Kenny Omega is going to walk out of Rebellion as this, you know, not unified, but, you know, he'll have all the championships. He'll be dripping in gold. And I wonder, it feels like with that loss last night, Impact is protecting Moose to be the one to beat Omega and take back the Impact title and bring the title back to Impact Wrestling. But get the title off of Rich Swann and transition it over to Moose when they're ready to put the belt back on an Impact performer. So that's kind of how I'm seeing things shaking out here. Only question is, when does he drop it? When is the right time then for Kenny Omega to lose to Moose or whoever it would be? I don't think it's right away, but I also don't think Impact wants a non-Impact star to be their champion for any length of time. You think Kenny Omega is going to be doing regular shots for Impact Wrestling? I don't think so. So there's still a lot of questions here. You know, these are the questions that you have to deal with when you're talking about doing interpromotional stuff like this. Impact is going to want certain things. AEW is going to want certain things. We already had those issues with Sammy Guevara a few weeks ago. How are they going to work this out? I would hope that they already have a plan. They already have something agreed to since the match has already been made. It would be kind of dumb if they haven't already talked this through and figured out exactly what the battle plan is. See, like if it's me, if I'm Tony Khan or I'm Scott D'Amore and I'm sitting down, across the table from me is the other guy. I'm sketching this thing out for the next 6 months. Not just in terms of who wins and who loses, but how, what, where, when, how long it's going to go on for, when does the title come back to one of my guys? I got this whole thing storyboarded out for at least the next 6 months. I don't know if that's the case here or not, but as a promoter, that would be the smart way to go about doing it. Wednesday's Dynamite ended with a big swerve during the Inner Circle War Council with Sammy Guevara returning. And he and Chris Jericho and the other members of the Inner Circle, they kicked MJF out of the group until MJF revealed the formation of his own group with Wardlow, Sean Spears, who used to be his drinking buddy in the audience during those early pandemic shows. Remember MJF and Sean Spears? They'd be drinking or playing cards and stuff out in the audience. So there's some long-term storytelling there. Didn't hit me right away, but I remembered. I said, wait a minute. There is actually a bit of history there. FTR and Tully Blanchard, also part of the group. It's like the New Horsemen. Only you've got six guys in there instead of four. I haven't seen anything reported anywhere about this. My first thought upon seeing this, and I said this on Wednesday as soon as the show went off the air, is that this is probably going to be your blood and guts match at some point. The Inner Circle against MJF's group. Now, not for a while, because we're just coming off of a not-so-exploding barbed wire death match. Maybe best to hold off a little bit longer on the blood and guts stuff. Maybe even get to do the show down the road when they're able to get back in another venue that isn't Daly's Place and actually get some more people into the building. So, you know, we could be talking a few months. It might not be that much longer, but this just feels to me like, okay, now you've got two teams and you don't want to do it right away, but this is going to be your blood and guts match at some point, I think later this year. I feel like this is going to be the new match. It was going to be the Elite against the Inner Circle, and now that's passé. There really isn't even an Elite anymore. So now it'll be MJF's group against the Inner Circle. Just seems perfectly set up to me. AEW Dark Elevation premieres tomorrow at 7 Eastern on YouTube, and every Monday thereafter, Paul White will be making his announcing debut alongside Tony Schiavone. The show has a main event of Riho against Maki Ito. Dynamite this Wednesday is a taped show with a lights-out unsanctioned main event pitting Thunder Rosa against Britt Baker. This will be the first time the ladies get to headline a Dynamite show. I am looking forward to that. This is going to be the biggest challenge to date in-ring for Britt Baker. We're gonna get to see what she can really do. We know what Thunder Rosa can do. And with Thunder Rosa in there, I think this can't be anything other than a good match. It's been a personal issue between these two for a while. If you're going to do this kind of match, it's a big stage for the women. If anything went wrong, they'll have the ability to edit it out since it's not live. But I'm looking forward to seeing how this plays out. And Jon Moxley is going to be teaming with Eddie Kingston to take on the now former Impact Tag Team Champions, the Good Brothers, Doc Gallows and Karl Anderson, who dropped the belts to Juice Robinson and David Finlay last night at the Impact Sacrifice pay-per-view, which would seem to pave the way for them to lose here. Since they don't have the belts anymore, it doesn't look too bad if they get beaten, since they're not the Impact Tag Champs anymore. And Cody Rhodes goes one-on-one with Penta. So that is those are the key matches coming up on TV this week. Over on the NXT side, William Regal promised two game-changing announcements on television this week. The first is the first ever two-night takeover. They are calling it Stand and Deliver, with night one airing live on USA the Wednesday before WrestleMania. And night two is going to be airing live on Peacock the very next night. So I could already tell this is going to be a very busy week. In fact, this might be the busiest week I've ever had, because we're going to be doing a lot that week. It's going to really kick off. I mean, the Hall of Fame is on that Tuesday. I don't know about going live after that, but certainly on Wednesday, that Wednesday before Mania, I'll be live after Dynamite for my Dynamite recap. I think after night two of NXT that Thursday, we'll probably go live for a double NXT TakeOver review. That Friday night, I'm thinking maybe after SmackDown, we'll do our WrestleMania prediction stream. And then we have back-to-back nights of WrestleMania, Saturday and Sunday. Live recaps both nights on YouTube. And a podcast to boot. I think that might be episode 699, I believe. I don't know what the format will be. Might be a shorter show, I don't know, but we'll have a podcast that Sunday. You'll get a double podcast that day. And then I'll be ready to drop dead by the time that week is over. But there's going to be a lot of good content coming. So we've got those two nights of TakeOver that week. For the second announcement, Regal invited the entire women's roster to line the aisleway, and he called Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez into the ring. Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez, they were the winners of the first ever Women's Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic. And they went on to suffer a great injustice in their Women's Tag Team title match the week before against Shayna Baszler and Nia Jax, when Baszler and Jax submitted the wrong person. The person who was not the legal person in the match. So they were screwed. And William Regal wanted to make that wrong. He wanted to right that wrong. And so what they have done is that they have now created a new set of women's tag team titles that are exclusive to the NXT brand. He pulled the towel off, and there were the championship belts. And he awarded the NXT women's tag team titles to Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez, who were bragging about it. They looked out at all the women in the aisleway. We beat all of you. We're better than all of you. Out comes Shotzi Blackheart and Ember Moon, who issue a challenge to them for the belts for later in the show, and William Regal likes that idea, and he makes the match. And unfortunately for Dakota and Raquel, their reign would not last very long. I'm going to have a lot more to say about this in a second, but I want to get through a few other things here. Io Shirai defending her NXT Women's Championship against Toni Storm. They had a very good match. Outcome was never in doubt. Never felt to me like this was meant to be Tony's title. It's meant to be Raquel's. And what they did on this show confirmed it. Confirmed that I was right. Io wins. We had Tony climbing up to the top rope, going for a big Harley Race or Bam Bam Bigelow-esque headbutt off the top rope, but she missed. And Io put her in a crossface, and Toni Storm tapped out. We got to the women's tag team title match. Shotzi and Ember challenging Dakota and Raquel. Also, very good match. Raquel was blocking stuff. She blocked the Eclipse attempt by Ember. And so they were kind of fighting over by the ring apron. Dakota inadvertently collided with Raquel Gonzalez. And they both went tumbling out of the ring. Ember Moon and Raquel, they go tumbling out over the top rope. Shotzi Blackheart rolls up Dakota Kai into a bridging pinfall and pins her to win the women's tag team titles. So, a lot to unpack here, okay? NXT has the strongest women's division in any promotion right now. Certainly in this country, okay? Strongest women's division by far. They can make this work. They can make it work by having their own tag team titles. I'm not saying it's going to be a disaster or it can't work. The talent is there. The talent is there. The bodies are there. The people are there. They don't have a lot of, they don't necessarily have a lot of stable tag teams. They have a few, but they'll have to form more of them. My whole thing is they didn't need them. This was not necessary. And if the end result was to get the titles on Shotzi and Ember, if that was going to be the end result all along, then they should have either won the Dusty Classic and then went on to beat Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler to win the women's tag team titles, or they should have awarded the winners of the Dusty Cup in the first place the new NXT Women's Tag Team Championship belts. Why weren't these titles up for grabs in the finals of the tournament? That tells me that they didn't even have the idea yet in their head. Because if they did, then this is completely just brain-dead stupid. You just had a tournament. First ever Women's Dusty Cup. What better way to ring in the very first than by not only awarding a trophy, but awarding a brand new set of women's tag team titles to the winners of the tournament? That would have made far more sense. I thought the way they handled this whole thing was completely bizarre. They just award them, and then they immediately drop them an hour later. And now what they've also done, by the way, is they've taken away one of the neat little features of the WWE women's tag team titles, which is that you have the ability to defend them if you want to in NXT, because you can go from brand to brand to brand. Well, now you're not going to be able to do that, because NXT has their own set of women's tag team titles. So you've now removed that neat little feature from the women's tag team belts. I always liked the idea of potentially having an NXT team holding the WWE women's tag belts and making appearances on Raw and SmackDown and mixing it up with some of the women down there. You've now eliminated that as a possibility. So I just think the move is completely unnecessary. I don't get why they handled it this way. It just doesn't make any logical sense to me. And NXT, more than the main roster, usually the stuff they do does tend to make a little bit more sense. This doesn't make any sense to me. The only good thing about taking the titles off of Dakota and Raquel so soon is that it frees up Gonzalez to now go ahead and challenge Io Shirai for the NXT Women's Championship at the next TakeOver show. And they already have started their path towards that match, because when Io retained over Toni Storm, they had a backstage segment. Dakota and Raquel were in the back, licking their wounds, very upset about their loss. Io Shirai showed up. She stared Raquel Gonzalez dead in the face and said that she wants her next. Raquel Gonzalez should be the one to end the reign of Io Shirai, and I believe she will. I believe she is your next women's champion. But if this is what they were going to do, there was absolutely no reason to just hand them the titles only to take them away from them. Again, I just think that was very dumb. The way they handled this was very dumb. We had a Jordan Devlin promo. He was sitting in an airport talking about how he is now, the travel restrictions for him have been lifted, teasing that he is coming to NXT. He's coming to the United States to once and for all determine who the real NXT Cruiserweight Champion is between himself and Santos Escobar. Both of them have titles, and they both claim to be the WWE or the NXT Cruiserweight Champion. There can only be one, and it looks like a TakeOver. We are probably headed for a unification match. And I say go ahead and let Devlin unify the titles and get the title off of Escobar, because Escobar can be doing much bigger things than just being limited to the Cruiserweight division. So I say a Jordan Devlin win at TakeOver in a hot match would be fine, and Santos Escobar can move on to bigger things. He is better than just being the Cruiserweight champion. Main event, Finn Balor retained his NXT title over Adam Cole. Very good match, very TakeOver-esque. Lots of kickouts and big moves and false finishes. Probably one too many in the final few minutes. It's an Adam Cole match. You're going to get that. Shotgun drop kick by Balor. Went up for the coup de grace. And Adam Cole moved out of the way and he hit Balor with a super kick and right in the jaw. And Balor was selling his surgically repaired jaw after that shot. And Cole put him in a crossface, trying to work over the jaw even more. Cole kept countering Balor, trying to reapply the hold every time he would try to, you know, get out of it. So Cole countered a 1916 attempt, super kick Balor in the knee, pulled down the knee pad. He was going for the last shot. Normally he would hit you in the back of the head with it. This time he delivered one right to the jaw, caught him right in the face with the knee, only got a near fall. Cole hit a Panama Sunrise. Balor kicked out again. Because that's what you do. With the destroyers these days, you can never get a pin with it. One of the things I absolutely hate. That WWE, AEW, every promotion does this. Drives me nuts. Cole got sent out of the ring. As he's recovering, he looks over in the empty audience area, and he sees Kyle O'Reilly, a very disheveled, angry-looking Kyle O'Reilly. Cole looks like he's seen a ghost. He ends up getting dropped on his head with the 1916 on the floor, rolled inside. Balor hits the coup de grace. Double stomp connects. 1-2-3, and Finn Balor is still your NXT champion. Kyle O'Reilly comes into the ring. He is going to confront Adam Cole, who is acting all apologetic. Of course, he then tries for a low blow. Kyle blocks him. Kyle rips off the Undisputed Era armband from his arm, and he proceeds to beat the crap out of Adam Cole. Undisputed no more. And officials came out. They held back Kyle, and Cole scurried away. Meanwhile, in the ring, Finn Balor is standing there watching all of this, and the way they shot this with their camera, you couldn't tell that there was somebody standing behind him, but without even looking, it's like he sensed it. Balor just sort of looks down, and he goes, "What took you so long?" And then the camera pans over and we see Karrion Kross. And the show ends with a face-to-face between Karrion Kross, who says, "TikTok." Him and Finn Balor clearly headed for TakeOver and not WrestleMania, it would seem, for their NXT Championship match. So the matches for TakeOver are coming together. The key matches are they're all right there. Finn Balor against Karrion Kross. Io Shirai defending against Raquel Gonzalez. Adam Cole against Kyle O'Reilly, maybe in some kind of stipulation. I was going to say last man standing, but I would think that last man standing with Drew and Sheamus at Fastlane makes more sense. I don't know if you want to be doing another last man standing match so soon after that one. But all the key matches are pretty much locked in. TakeOver is looking big. You know, again, normally the thing I love about the TakeOver shows, they're not very long. They usually keep them to about 5 matches. Now we're getting a double dose of TakeOver. So do you do 5 matches on both nights for a total of 10? You know, even with 2 nights, that seems like a lot. But that's probably what they'll end up doing. So you have to expect that Shotzi and Ember will put the women's tag belts on the line. Probably against Candice LeRae and Indy Hartwell. There was a little bit of a tease for that on this show. When they were in the back celebrating their win, Candice did not look thrilled about it, so I could see that being your women's tag team title match. You know, Gargano puts the North American title on the line. They could do something with LA Knight and Bronson Reed. They had another tease on this show. Backstage pull apart between the two of them. LA Knight is going to be making his in-ring debut on TV this Wednesday. That could be a takeover match on the undercard as well. But like I said before, I'll be going live after night 2. We'll do a Dynamite review as usual that Wednesday. And that Thursday, we can recap both nights. It's going to be a busy week. WrestleMania week is going to be crazy. And I hope you'll come along for the ride and support the channel.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history. 28 years ago this week on March 9th, 1993. You know, it's the small things that puts a smile on my face. We could talk about all the big events in wrestling history, and we will. But nothing puts a smile on my face like the Toxic Turtles, who made their one and only WWE appearance at the Wrestling Challenge tapings on this date in Augusta, Georgia. Timmy and Tommy Turtle portrayed by Barry Hardy and Gilbert himself, Dwayne Gill. You can find this match on the WWE Unreleased Matches 1986 to 1995 DVD that I reviewed on the YouTube channel, actually, years ago. Hardy and Gill were very often used as enhancement talent. I mean, I can remember as a younger fan, Barry Hardy would have a lot of singles matches. Dwayne Gill was always around, you know, at least in the early 90s he was. So I think if you grew up watching those old syndicated shows, you definitely saw them lose their fair share of matches. You've definitely heard of those two names before. These guys would do anything to get noticed. And they had these two Ninja Turtle knockoff costumes made to take with them wherever they went. TV tapings, independent shows, because you just never know, I guess, when the Shredder and his foot soldiers may attack. So you gotta bring your turtle costumes around with you wherever you go. These were so clearly Raphael and Donatello knockoffs. If these ever made television, WWE would have been sued into oblivion. Actually, they probably would have just gotten a cease and desist. But these never would have made TV. Dwayne Gill told this story in an interview on WWE.com. He would wear the costume very often in the locker room, and he would dance around like a fool to pop the boys. He wanted to just entertain people in the locker room. And one day he's doing this, and he looks up, and who does he see in front of him? But he sees Vince McMahon standing there. And Vince McMahon goes, "Who the hell is inside that thing?" And Dwayne Gill takes the mask, he takes the head off, and Vince just goes, "I should have known. You got another one of those?" And Gilbert says, "Yep." "Well, put them on, because you're wrestling in 10 minutes. And that's how the match came to be. Instead of the Ninja Turtles, they came out as the Toxic Turtles. The absolute best part of this match is when Donatello goes for a cover and the opponent kicks out. And Donatello lands on his back. He lands on his shell. And he can't move. All he can do is flail around. He's flailing his arms and his legs around because he's on his shell. He's stuck. He can't move. And Raphael had to come into the ring and grab him and just roll him over. I thought that was fantastic. The people did not think that this was fantastic. The people in the audience that night, they turned on this match something fierce. They started booing. Gilbert says that when he got to the back, Vince was laughing his ass off. He loved the entire thing. But sadly, that was the end of the Toxic Turtles. I'm pretty sure that was the only appearance they ever made at any of these TV tapings, and they never actually did make TV. But it's nice to know that WWE did Chikara before Chikara ever did Chikara. 25 years ago this week, on the March 11th, 1996 episode of Monday Night Raw, the Ringmaster was the Ringmaster no more. In his place was Stone Cold Steve Austin, using that name for the very first time in a match against Savio Vega. 24 years ago this week, on March 10th, 1997, the day after Biggie Smalls was shot and killed, it was the debut of the new Raw is War format and the dawning of a new era that really is still with us to this very day. Raw has largely retained the same basic look for its show ever since. So the first Raw that we got the giant Titantron, we got the rampway to the ring. We had a new intro, we had new theme music, The Beautiful People by Marilyn Manson, which, due to some kind of rights issue, I guess, it did not last very long. I think they had the music for about 2 or 3 weeks, and that was pretty much the end of it. They switched over to the Thorn in Your Eye for hour one, that song from the WWF Full Metal, the album, volume one, right? They had that for hour one, and they used the We're All Together song for hour two, because they broke the show up into two shows, something for Nielsen ratings purposes. Hour one, I think, was Raw. An hour or two became Warzone. I think that's how it worked. But yeah, some people may not be aware that Raw used The Beautiful People years before SmackDown ever did. But the show featured a main event of Psycho Sid and The Undertaker against Vader and Mankind. It featured The Undertaker doing a giant dive out over the top rope onto the heels. wiping out all of the heels on the floor. Probably the first instance of Undertaker doing this dive that I can remember. Now, I know he did it at the Ground Zero pay-per-view later on that year. And he obviously did it many more times over the years in the Inferno match with Kane, right? He jumped over the flames out of the ring, and it became a staple in a lot of his WrestleMania matches in later years. I'm just trying to think of if there was ever a time I saw him do that top rope dive out of the ring before this, and I can't think of any. This might have been the first time that I've ever seen him do that before. And it happened here on this show. It also featured one of the more memorable segments in Raw history, the great debate between Jerry the King Lawler and Paul Heyman, accompanied by an entourage of ECW talent. ECW had a very big presence on Raw weeks earlier at the Manhattan Center, and Lawler was working an angle where he hated ECW. I don't think it was much of an angle, really. Not that I didn't like it, just that I don't think he was really doing too much acting. I really don't think he liked a lot of those ECW people. He definitely had no love lost with Paul Heyman. Controlled animosity is how Jim Ross described it between the two of them on his Grilling JR podcast. Lawler admitted years ago on one of those Legends Roundtable shows that WWE did on the old 24/7 service before the network launched, that he broke Paul Heyman's jaw on purpose years ago. I think it was in 1987 in Memphis. They worked together. Now, my understanding of the story, and I could have the details twisted here, but my understanding is that Heyman was in, he was in Memphis. They had plans to work a scaffold match. I don't know who else would have been involved, unless it's possible maybe it was just going to be Lawler against Heyman. But whatever the angle was, the night of the first match, Heyman refused to climb up the scaffold because he said he was afraid of heights. And I don't know how they got around it that night, but they did, and they got the match done. And I think they actually may have taken the match to different towns. They may have taken it on a loop around different towns in the area down there. And on the very last night, before they were to have that final match on that loop, I guess, Lawler punched Heyman right in the mouth, and he broke his jaw on purpose. And Heyman told the website UGO.com back in 2008 that Lawler broke his jaw before the match and that he has always taken liberties with other people, especially those who, by the nature of the situation, had to place some kind of trust in him. Fuck him. I don't spend any time in my life thinking about him. He is in the past where he belongs. And no, I am not surprised he is still talking about me. If half his locker room banged my wife, I guess I would hold a grudge too. Yowie wowie. Those are some stinging comments there from Paul Heyman. So yeah, I would say there's always been some heat there between the two of them. I think it's safe to say. But if working with Lawler is what it would take to promote ECW's first pay-per-view the following month, then so be it. And Paul Heyman was more than happy to come and do it. The Great Debate had Lawler and Heyman at a podium in the ring. Jim Ross was the moderator, and Lawler kept insulting them and saying the WWE sells out the Philadelphia Spectrum every time they run there, 20,000 people, while ECW brags about filling up a bingo hall with 1,100 people every month. And as Lawler is talking, you can see the Dudley Boys and Tommy Dreamer and the Sandman and the Eliminators. All these ECW guys standing around behind Heyman just like salivating and chomping at the bit, just waiting to get their hands on this guy and just kill him. And then he and Heyman start shooting on each other, and Lawler says Heyman must be a little light in the loafers, since all he wants to do is hang out with all these ECW guys. He can never be a real athlete himself, and that's why he hangs around other athletes. And Heyman came back with a crack about Lawler's taste in, shall we say, younger women. So it all breaks down in the end, and Lawler realizes he's in trouble, and he warns, don't make me call back there to my friends. I got people in the back ready to come out and help me. And of course, he calls to the back, and nobody comes out to his defense, so he just bails out of the ring, and that was the end of the segment. Psycho Sid defeated Bret Hart in a steel cage dark match, which they had been doing for days at a lot of the live events before this, all with the same finish of Sid escaping the cage as Bret Hart is trying to climb out over the top. A week after this is when they did the match on television, and it led to one of my all-time favorite segments in Raw history, which I get to talk about next week. 22 years ago this week, on March 8th, 1999, it was the great Kevin Nash experiment on a three-hour edition of WCW Monday Nitro. Nash had become the head booker for the month, actually, I think it was the month before. He became the head booker in WCW, and on this night, we were a mere 6 days away from their uncensored pay-per-view. Here is an excerpt from the Death of WCW book by Brian Alvarez and R.D. Reynolds. Nash's first move was to present a Nitro that featured no wrestling in the first hour. None. Not a single solitary match. You might recall that Nitro was a wrestling show. Apparently, Nash thought that wrestling on this wrestling show was unnecessary, and he booked the show like this to prove that they could draw the same rating if they had zero matches in the first hour as they would if there were 10. And the thing about it is, Nash largely turned out to be right, although they still got crushed by WWE. I mean, they were getting slaughtered at that point left and right. Nitro did a 4.4 rating, which was pretty much in line with what they had been doing before that. So around that time, they were pretty much doing the same numbers. Raw scored a full 2 ratings points higher with a 6.4. The Ric Flair-Bill Goldberg main event did a 4.6 final quarter and a 5.7 overrun. While over on Raw, Stone Cold against Mankind did a 6 rating. The finish of both shows combined for a rating of nearly 12 and a combined share of more than 21, which is just astonishing. Anybody who knows anything about ratings and share and all that, think about that. On cable, no less. On cable, a 12 rating and a 21 share combined for pro wrestling on a Monday night in 1999. And that just gives you a snapshot of how absolutely gigantic pro wrestling was at that time. We never even saw the inside of the building in the first 60 minutes of that Nitro show, and the people who bought tickets paid to watch this shit on a screen. So if I were in the building that night, I wouldn't be very happy about that. But we were treated to segments like a Nitro party out in Rhode Island, with Conan, Kidman, and the Nitro girls partying with a bunch of college kids. It literally looked like a giant frat party. And the wrestlers just so happened to be there with drinks in their hands, being interviewed by, what was that guy, DJ Ran, whatever the guy's name was. They had brought this DJ guy in to host a lot of the Nitro parties at that time. So that was one of the segments. In another segment, we had Scott Steiner and Buff Bagwell being pulled over by the cops in Boston while driving a Hummer limo. And Steiner was in the driver's seat, so you got to picture this. This long Hummer limo pulled over on the side of the road, and there's Big Papa Pump in the driver's seat. And the cops recognized, they told him to get out of the car. The cops recognized who they were, and they ended up deputizing them as cops so that they can help them fight crime. Because that's what the cops do. If they pull you over and they go, hey, I know who you are, I'll tell you what. I'm going to make you an honorary cop, and you're going to help me hunt the bad guys. Because, of course, that's how it works. But the main entree of all of these segments was Torrie Wilson, for whatever reason, is at a gun range, firing a gun. She's shooting at the range when she is interrupted by Hollywood Hogan and Kevin Nash. They have arrived at the shooting range. They've asked the front desk person, is Torrie Wilson here? Oh, yeah, she's inside. Okay, and they go walking in. And this was a scene right out of a bad porno movie. Although, I've always wondered, when I hear that expression, are there good porno movies? I don't know that there's such a thing as a good porno or a bad porno. No one's really watching it for the acting, I wouldn't think. Anyway, they make dinner plans for later in the night, where we later find Hogan and Nash. They are dining the beautiful Miss Wilson. There is a camera here showing their dinner. And they are plotting. They are plotting to take down Ric Flair, who Hulk Hogan is facing at the pay-per-view. Oh, by the way, there's a pay-per-view that Sunday with a Hulk Hogan-Ric Flair main event. So keep that in mind. So they are plotting ways that they could take down the Nature Boy in advance of this big pay-per-view main event that's coming up. What do we do about the kid, says Hogan. The kid being Ric Flair's son, David, who Tori was involved with on camera at that time. What do we do about the kid? And Tori talks about how she has this really, really hot friend. I mean, like, really hot, who they're apparently waiting on. They're waiting on this woman to show up. And Hogan says, well, you know, if you're a 10, well, how hot is your friend? And Tori says, oh, my friend is a 12. And Hogan can't believe it. He can't believe that's even possible. So the friend eventually shows up, and of course she's going by the name Mrs. Robinson, because of course she is. Eventually she shows up, and Hogan is just fawning over her, and Nash promises the woman. All of this really happened, by the way. I just rewatched it the other day. This all really happened. Nash promises the woman $20,000 to sleep with David Flair. And she only gets the money when the job is done. I don't think we got an actual match, and of course the job, you can figure out what the job is. I don't think we got an actual match until 15 minutes after the second hour, once they finally did make it back into the arena. They immediately started with what else? An interview segment. So I don't think we actually got a match until probably 9:10 or 9:15 or something that night. And it was Raven against Hack. So two former ECW guys going one-on-one. Was the first match of the night, almost midway into the show, here in what I call the great Kevin Nash experiment. There really is no one quite like Kevin Nash. 11 years ago this week, on March 8th, 2010, the new Monday Night War began with a whimper for Impact Wrestling opposite Monday Night Raw. This was their big first full-time night head-to-head with WWE after their big January 4th show where they peaked with over 2 million viewers at one point. They did so well that Spike TV decided to move them on a permanent basis to Monday nights. The big hook for this show were the in-ring debuts, the in-ring returns of Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair. This was Hogan's first televised match since his win over Randy Orton at SummerSlam back in 2006, 4 years before this. And this was Flair's first televised match since his retirement match. I can't even say that with a straight face. His retirement match with Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 24. Both these guys had already had other matches off television. They even wrestled each other. They had this big tour of Australia, which was so sad to watch. If you go back and look up photos of that, I mean, they look like they're fucking 90 years old, bleeding all over the place. It's just, it's disgusting. But this was their first matches on TV in quite a while. Hogan tagged with the Monster Abyss in a win over Flair and AJ Styles. And Rob Van Dam made his TNA debut as a surprise opponent for Sting, pinning Sting in just 10 seconds. For all their efforts, TNA was soundly destroyed. They weren't just beaten. They were beaten and bloodied and murdered and brought back to life and then beaten again by WWE to the tune of a 3.4 Nielsen rating for Raw to TNA's 0.98. And the salt in the wound is that their Thursday replay of the show actually did a better number than their live airing did. 19 years ago this week, on March 11th, 2002, Monday Night Raw aired live from the Joe in Detroit with a mega main event, pitting Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock against all three members of the NWO who had just debuted in the company the month before, Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall, and Kevin Nash. Just 6 days before WrestleMania 18, Hogan pinned The Rock with a leg drop, the only time he would pin The Rock in his career. And it was the one and only time that Hulk Hogan and Stone Cold Steve Austin shared a ring on opposite sides against each other in an actual match. They even mixed it up. At one point, they tagged in together, and it just, you know, when I watch that back, it's like, this should have been this big, momentous moment. And there were people in the crowd who definitely popped when they both tagged in together, but boy, this should have been such a bigger moment than it was. But it was the only time they ever worked against each other in a match. And what a match it was to just give away on free TV. 18 years ago this week on March 11th, 2003, at the SmackDown taping in his hometown of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Kurt Angle successfully defended his WWE Championship against Brock Lesnar. Yes, weeks before their main event at WrestleMania 19, WWE promoted a title match between Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar on SmackDown. And so you may be wondering, well, why? Why would they do this? Why would they give away their WrestleMania main event early like that just weeks before the show? Because Kurt Angle's neck was broken. I mean, I know, the sky is blue, water is wet, grass is green, and Kurt Angle has a broken freaking neck. But Kurt Angle's neck was all jacked up. He needed surgery. And the plan was for him to drop the title to Lesnar on TV, and Brock would then instead defend against a different opponent at WrestleMania 19, that opponent being Chris Benoit. Kurt Angle had an MRI done on his neck a week before this. Plans were made for him to have neck surgery with Dr. Lloyd Youngblood out of San Antonio, the same doctor who operated on Steve Austin's neck and Benoit's neck, Edge, Rhino, Lita. A whole host of other WWE stars went to Dr. Youngblood for that spinal fusion surgery. And it would have kept Angle out of the ring for at least a year, possibly would have ended his career. That was Dr. Youngblood's recommendation in a memo that he sent to the, you know, powers that be in WWE. His recommendation was that Kurt never wrestle again. His neck was that bad. He recommended that he never wrestle another match again. And what the good doctor wanted to do, he wanted to fuse four of Angle's vertebrae, which would have been it for him. If you have four of them fused, you're done. That's it. There's no more wrestling ever again. And surgery was scheduled for St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, and plans were in motion for a title change here at the tapings until Angle went to Vince McMahon the day before. The day before the taping, Kurt went to Vince and he pled with him. He asked him permission. Please, let me wrestle at WrestleMania. Let's do the match. Let me go in there against Brock. I'll put him over. I'll drop the title. I'll do the job and then I'll go on and I'll have my surgery. And he talked to Vince about it. He talked to Brock about it. He talked to Benoit. Because he would be taking that opportunity away from Chris Benoit. Chris Benoit was going to get a huge spot here on the WrestleMania card, and Kurt went to him as well to kind of tell him, okay, here's what I'm thinking. I'm sorry, but like, I really want to keep this match. And so instead, what they ended up doing here, because they had already announced the match, they did a very quick match where Kurt Angle came to the ring. He went into the corner. He was kneeling down in the corner like he was saying a prayer. And when the camera shifted over to Brock during his entrance, they swapped Kurt out for his brother, Eric Angle, who was dressed exactly like Kurt Angle, wearing the same singlet, the same red hoodie that Angle had come out wearing. And so Brock comes into the ring. He starts beating the hell out of who he thought was Kurt, hits him with an F5, and when he goes for the pin, he stops and gets up and he realizes, wait a minute, that's not Kurt. Meanwhile, Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas, they were members of Team Angle, they show up in the aisleway, they provide the distraction. So Brock now is distracted by the two of them. And in the time that Brock and the referee are distracted, Kurt rolls back into the ring and rolls his brother out, and he lays there. And when Brock Lesnar turns around and goes to pick him up, Angle cradles him for the win, and he retains the title. This was Brock Lesnar's first non-pay-per-view television loss. And in the end, instead of going with Dr. Youngblood for the operation, who, like I said, Dr. Youngblood was of the opinion that this man should never wrestle again. I want to fuse four of his vertebrae in his neck because his neck is that bad. Kurt obviously didn't like that, and he wanted a second opinion. There was another doctor who did neck surgery on some wrestlers, including Scott Hall. And Kurt made the decision instead to go with Dr. Haedong Jo out of his hometown of Pittsburgh. And instead of fusing four vertebrae in his neck and ending his career, he elected to have only two of his vertebrae fused. It was a minimally invasive procedure that would have had him back in the ring within 4 to 6 weeks. Now think about that. How do you go from having one doctor who clearly is an expert in this and has done this operation on many wrestlers before, who looks at your scans and your tests and your neck and says, boy, your neck is so bad. I would recommend you never set foot in a ring again, and I want to fuse four of your vertebrae. You're probably going to be recovering for over a year. How do you go from that to having a minimally invasive procedure that puts you back in the ring in 4 to 6 weeks? Well, you can do it because it's only a stopgap. It's not going to fix the problem. It's only going to get you back in the ring a little bit faster, but you're going to end up needing neck surgery anyway. But that's what Kurt wanted. That's what he elected to do. And look, Kurt was back in the ring by June. By the end of the year, all it took was one vicious chair shot to the top of his head by Brock Lesnar to undo the entire surgery. And he broke his neck again. I don't even know how the man's head stays secured to his neck with all the damage that's been done to it over the years. Have you seen Kurt Angle's neck? It really stood out to me when he dressed up that one time on TV a few years ago. There was a battle royal, I think, on TV. And this was before his retirement match with Baron Corbin at WrestleMania. But he dressed up as the Conquistador in that gold costume. And he could barely get the mask on. You could tell because it didn't come down to cover his neck. So I knew exactly who was under the mask right away. I mean, all you had to do was look at his neck. I've never seen a neck like that in my life. All that swelling. Kurt Angle has the fattest neck that I have ever seen in my entire life. So all I did was look at the back of the guy's head. I said, oh, that's Kurt Angle. But just think of the abuse and the suplexes and the bumps and everything that this guy has taken to the neck, all because when he broke it in the Olympics, he never had it fixed. Had he had it fixed, who knows? It would have prolonged his career maybe even longer. I mean, now he's got other issues. He's got atrophy in his arms. He's got knee problems. He'll always have the neck problems, but he's broken his neck about 4 or 5 different times, which is why it's probably looks so swollen. But yeah, it's crazy to think about that the plan had been hatched for him to drop the belt on TV. It was going to be Lesnar and Benoit as our WrestleMania 19 main event, but Angle pled his case to Vince McMahon and begged and pleaded, and he got him to change his mind. 17 years ago this week, on March 13, 2004, the WWE Hall of Fame was revived for the first time since 1996 with an induction ceremony held at the Hilton Hotel in New York City. The class of 04 included Jesse the Body Ventura, Bobby the Brain Heenan, Superstar Billy Graham, Don Morocco, Tito Santana, Big John Studd, Sergeant Slaughter, Greg the Hammer Valentine, Harley Race, and the Junkyard Dog, with Pete Rose rounding out the crew as the celebrity inductee into what was now being called the celebrity wing of the Hall of Fame. And with the success of the DVD, because they put the whole ceremony on DVD, it did so well that they decided to make the Hall of Fame an annual part of WrestleMania weekend going forward, and to bring the event into actual arenas, which I think was a mistake. And I think it should revert back to banquet halls with very limited fans or no fans at all, like they had for this event. Bobby Heenan's induction speech is still, in my opinion, the greatest Hall of Fame speech ever given in company history. My eyes never fail to well up a little bit at the very end of that speech when he says, you know, the one thing that's missing, I wish Monsoon was here. He wishes Gorilla Monsoon was there with him at that ceremony. Boy, he and everybody else, those two were gold together. It brings a smile to my face when I see them on the old shows and I hear their commentary, but it also makes me very sad when I realize that, you know, in today's age, and I don't know how old would Gorilla Monsoon even be today, but, you know, even if you go back a few years, even in their older age, in the age of podcasts and all this stuff that, you know, WWE does on their website and stuff. Imagine the gold that we still could have gotten potentially if they were, you know, healthy enough from Monsoon and Heenan if they were alive. You know, Monsoon died in 99 from cancer. But then you've got Bobby Heenan, even just Heenan alone. Can you imagine a Bobby Heenan podcast? Or Bobby Heenan on social media? That's why people went crazy years ago when they thought it was really him on Twitter and it turned out to be an imposter and his wife had to, you know, get that shut down. But Bobby got sick, and of all things to get sick with, he got sick with throat cancer. And to me, that was always the cruelest twist of fate. You have a guy who made money. He made his money. He made a living with his mouth, with his voice, as a manager, as a mouthpiece, as an announcer. And of all the things to be afflicted with, it took away his voice. It took away his speech. It took away his ability to speak and to communicate. And there could be no crueler fate than that for somebody who based their entire career around talking. And every time I think about that, it makes me very sad. But this Hall of Fame speech, even with the speech problems he was having, because he had already gone through a first bout with throat cancer by this point. So, you know, certain parts, it was a little hard to understand what he was saying. But still, to this day, the best Hall of Fame speech that I have ever seen at any WWE Hall of Fame ceremony. The very next day, on March 14th, WWE hosted what may end up going down as the last ever WrestleMania to be held inside Madison Square Garden, WrestleMania 20. Remember the tagline? Where it all begins again. Given that now we have cities lined up bidding for WrestleMania, bidding on these big stadium shows where they can get 60 and 80 and 100,000 people into the buildings, it is very possible we will never again see WrestleMania inside the Garden. Although, you know, forever is a long time. They could always do WrestleMania in the Garden and just jack up ticket prices. That's always a possibility. But the show is remembered mostly for the closing shot of Chris Benoit fresh off winning the World Heavyweight title from Triple H and Shawn Michaels in a triple threat match, celebrating in the ring and embracing his best friend, WWE champion Eddie Guerrero, both men with title belts, not the biggest, not the most popular. They were never the megastars like an Austin or a Hogan or a Rock or anybody on that level, but they were two of the best at their craft. And there were a lot of people who probably never envisioned them standing there together at the end of a WrestleMania as champion. It was a very emotional moment for both of them, and the confetti is falling from the ceiling. Now, of course, it's one of the most bittersweet moments in company history. It's actually really depressing to see that moment. I know some people will still look at that and it makes them happy, but just knowing how things turned out for both of them, I can't not watch that and just be fucking depressed when I see that. But The Undertaker made his return as a hybrid of the Dead Man and the Big Evil character, with Paul Bearer returning to be his manager in a win over Kane. It was also the final match in their respective runs, their first runs in the company, for Bill Goldberg and Brock Lesnar. Bill Goldberg was working on a one-year deal. That one-year deal was coming up, and he was not interested in renewing. And originally, the idea was that Brock would go in there. I think Vince had promised Brock, you're going to go in there and you're going to beat Goldberg in about 30 seconds. That was until Brock Lesnar made the decision that I don't want to be here anymore either. And he had told Vince McMahon at the beginning of the month about his decision to leave. And I think shortly after that, he told the locker room about his decision to leave. And, you know, and there was a lot of ill feelings towards Brock because the company had built everything around this guy, around this young kid. They brought him in. They gave him the big push. They put the title on him. They put him over all of the top guys, from Big Show to Undertaker, The Rock, everybody. They wanted to put him over Stone Cold on Raw in a King of the Ring qualifier. And Stone Cold said, fuck you, and he went home. Although he had other reasons for doing that. But the point is, they invested so much in this guy and they put him over everybody to make him look like a monster. And now he wanted to just pick up and leave. So you can kind of, I mean, look, and that's his call. Can't begrudge the guy for that, but you can also understand why there would have been some animosity towards him in the company. Look at this. He's bailing on us. This guy got the biggest push of his life and now he's walking away. Well, the fans in the building that night, you are in New York, you do have a lot of smart fans in the audience, and they knew what was up. They knew that both these guys were headed for the exit door, and boy, did they make them know about it. They booed these fuckers out of this building. The most popular person in the match was the referee. Stone Cold Steve Austin was the enforcer. He was the special referee for the match. He got the best reaction out of anybody. But everybody knew that Goldberg was on his way out, and they knew that Lesnar was on his way out too, and they booed them into oblivion. The Rock tagged with Mick Foley against Evolution in a handicap match, and it would be nearly 8 years before The Rock wrestled another match, and it would, funny enough, be right back in that same building, Madison Square Garden in 2011, for a tag match with John Cena against The Miz and R-Truth. Trish Stratus turned heel on Chris Jericho and aligned with Christian, and John Cena opened the show in his first of many WrestleMania matches, beating The Big Show to win the United States Championship. 10 years ago this week, on March 13th, 2011, TNA has played home to its fair share of embarrassing moments and embarrassing situations over the years. Many, many or all of which have been well documented over the years on this podcast over the last decade plus. But maybe none were worse than what we saw at their Victory Road pay-per-view here in 2011. With Jeff Hardy in no condition to perform. He wasn't even in any condition to stand up straight, let alone get in the ring and wrestle. Sting pinned him in the main event in just 88 seconds in the main event of this show to retain the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. It took Jeff 45 seconds after his music initially started playing to even walk out through the curtain. He was clearly under the influence of something, or everything. Referee Brian Hebner could see that something was wrong. He threw up the dreaded X6 signal before the match even started. When does that happen? That the referee throws up the dreaded X and the match hasn't even begun yet. That brought out Eric Bischoff. I'm not even sure what his role was at this point in the company. But he worked there. He came in with Hogan. He was in some position of authority behind the scenes. Even though he might claim otherwise, that he had no power. But here comes Eric Bischoff down to the ring, who communicated something to Hardy. Then he walked over to Sting, and he clearly was trying to communicate something to Sting, all while cutting a promo on the fly. He's trying to communicate to these guys, basically, you know, we need to go home here. His orders were very clear. Take it home quickly. And Sting did. He dropped Jeff down with the Scorpion Death Drop, held his legs down for the pin as Jeff tried to kick out. Sting looked like a disappointed dad in there when this thing was over. The fans were chanting bullshit. Sting turned to somebody in the crowd who chanted that and said, I agree. Now, 4 years ago at a Q&A at the Wales Comic Con, Sting made an appearance. He was asked about that match at Victory Road. He had this to say. Jeff was in a bad way. He was deteriorating as the day went on. By the time our match rolled around, it became clear that he could not compete, and so I had to take him down quickly. He has since turned it all around. I love Jeff. I love his work. I hold nothing against him, and I wish him all the best. Eric Bischoff, on his 83 Weeks podcast, had this to say about the situation. He got into some details here about what happened. This is from his point of view. And hat tip to Wrestling Inc. for the transcription on this. Jeff's MO at the time was to get to Universal Studios, check in, and go hide until it was absolutely necessary to come out, and it was either interview time or match time. To this day, I don't know where he hid. He would show up, he would wave, and he would hide until 6 o'clock. I think on this night, it's safe to assume he was hiding wherever he was hiding and doing whatever drugs he brought with him. I'm no expert on drugs, but I have seen enough of it from a distance and up close to recognize it. The agent looked at me like, what the fuck are we going to do? It took forever to find Jeff. He was really late getting to Gorilla. Knowing and hearing that they were having a difficult time finding him, I made my way over to Gorilla. When I saw Jeff approaching, I didn't notice Jeff being twisted up as much as I did the agent's face. Once I got close to Jeff, it was obvious he was fucked up. Whoever the agent was essentially said he's too fucked up to work. Then it became, who's calling this? It wasn't my job. I was the executive producer of the television show. I technically had no authority whatsoever, and no official role in the pay-per-view unless I was a talent or was asked to input on creative. I was just kind of standing there waiting for someone to make a decision, and no decisions are being made, and now Jeff is making his way down to the ring. There was no captain of the ship in Gorilla. It was my exchange with Dixie that was the catalyst for me to say, fuck it, nobody else is going to do anything. The bell is going to ring and it can't go down like this. I don't want to make this sound like I'm putting myself over or I cared so much about Sting. I was concerned about the show. I didn't want Sting to go out there and try to have a match with a guy who was completely fucking wasted. I wasn't worried about Sting getting hurt, but the match would have been the shits, and I didn't want Sting to be in that position. Sting had no idea that Jeff was going to show up fucked up. I'm looking for a decision. I'm looking for somebody to come up with an idea. We don't have a lot of time, folks. Can't call a meeting. Somebody has to call the ball. Who's going to call it? Fuck it. I literally walked through the curtain not knowing what I was going to do. There were two things that crossed my mind. My first thought was for me and my heel character to go out and knock him out. Just drop him and then have the referee call the match and the disqualification. By the time I walked through the curtain, got halfway down to the ring, I realized that wouldn't work because there was a no DQ stip. So I started improvising a story and laying out a promo. What I was trying to do was buy time to figure out how to communicate to Jeff, the referee, and to Sting. Now I gotta rewrite the show while I'm in the ring and the show is happening and one of the people in the match is completely disabled and unable to continue. So I did what I did. I basically told Jeff, take his finish, we're gonna shorten this up, take the fucking finish. I went to Sting, now that's where I had to get more creative. Because I was trying to talk to Sting while at the same time I'm trying to cut a promo and hide all of this from the viewing audience and make it look like it's part of the show. I basically told Sting, hit him with your finish, get him the fuck out of here, let's go home. Sting was able to communicate with the referee, so that was it. The overwhelming fog that settled in backstage was disappointing for Sting. It was a horrible position for him to be in at that stage of his career. At his level of stardom, to subject someone like Sting to a situation like that was embarrassing and undeserved. I think it reflected a tremendous amount of lack of professionalism within the entire TNA organization from top to bottom, and I think people were genuinely sad for Jeff. It was disappointing for Sting and sadness for Jeff. That was the overwhelming sense. Nobody was second-guessing anything or blaming anybody or pointing any fingers. It was really just sad more than anything. I'll tell you what was sad. What was sad is that it even got to the point where nobody had the balls to step in and stop him from going out to the ring. I love how Bischoff himself says that the agent, he doesn't name who it was, but the agent said, literally said, he's too fucked up to go out to the ring. Nobody stopped him. Nobody grabbed his arm and said, hey, Jeff, come here for a second. Nobody tackled him. Nobody can call an audible here. Nobody can say, hey, Jeff, come back here for a second. And let's just, we'll have Sting in the ring and let's communicate down to the referee and down to Sting what's going on. Tell them to stall for a little bit. Maybe Sting issues an open challenge. We'll try to wrangle somebody up back here in the meantime. And there's always ways that you can try to do something. Obviously, the main event was not supposed to go 88 seconds, so they had a certain amount of time left on the air that night before, the pay-per-view was to be over. I'm not saying it's an easy thing to do. I'm not saying I am at all envious of the position that this put the people who worked for the company in. But you cannot allow this guy to go out to the ring if you can visually see, oh shit, this guy is so fucked up. To let him walk through the curtain is absolutely ridiculous. There is no excuse for allowing that to happen. That is total amateur hour. There was no good scenario, I don't think, where the fans don't end up getting screwed somehow. But I think you could have stopped him from going out. Sent Bischoff out for a promo, just like he did on his own. Send Bischoff out for a promo to stall until somebody who wrestled earlier in the night is able to be sent out there to challenge Sting to a match. Like, for example, an AJ Styles. AJ had a match earlier on in the show, so he was there. But, you know, these guys are also athletes. I understand both sides of the coin. These guys are athletes, and you can't always send them out cold like that because that's how injuries happen. I think back to the Tyson Kidd thing in WWE where he was supposed to have a match, the dark match, right, with Samoa Joe, and those guys didn't have any time to really warm up and stretch and prepare, and that was probably as much as anything to do with why he got hurt that night. So these guys are not machines that you can just push a button and program them and send them out there. They have to get ready. And if AJ already wrestled the match, maybe he hit the showers. Who knows? But you cannot allow Jeff Hardy to go out there in that condition. Forgetting the fact that he's a danger to himself and a danger to his opponent, just him going out there like that is fucking embarrassing. You could have tried to call something on the fly, and I don't know if it would have worked. But you cannot allow that to happen. You cannot allow that guy when you have the agent saying he is too messed up to go out there. How does nobody have the balls to stand up and say, okay, I'm going to take charge here? Is everybody just standing around waiting for somebody else to actually stand up and make a move? So Jeff ended up being sent home from the Impact tapings the following week, and he returned to the company later that year in September. But I'm glad he's doing better these days. Jeff now here in 2021 is seemingly in a better place. He's had other issues in recent years. Who's to say what the future is going to hold? But for the time being, it looks like Jeff has gotten himself to a good place, and that's good to see. And 1 year ago this week, the world changed. The world was shut down by a global pandemic that we are still in the middle of. That I don't think it's much of an exaggeration to say has changed all of our lives, even if only temporarily. It affected everybody, it affected everything. From how and where we work, to entertainment and sporting events and everything in between. Pro wrestling was not spared. Pro wrestling is a business that is based entirely on live crowd reaction and audience participation, and all of a sudden it was thrust into this weird world of emptiness, of empty arena shows and no fans. In other cases, you had companies shut down completely until it was safe to reopen. WWE never did shut down. They were building towards a WrestleMania at Raymond James Stadium with Roman Reigns challenging Bill Goldberg for the Universal Championship, and The Undertaker wrestling AJ Styles, and John Cena wrestling The Fiend, and the pandemic completely upended all of those plans. And on March 13th, 2020, WWE ran its first live show from the Performance Center in Orlando with Michael Cole and Triple H on commentary. What a team they were. One of the weirdest shows that I have ever seen. It all just felt so unsettling in front of an audience of empty chairs. 1 year later, we still don't have fans back in the buildings for the WWE main roster shows. NXT has some fans every week, but we still have no fans back in the buildings for Raw and for SmackDown. But that's all about to change with WrestleMania. And I look forward to the day that we can put all of this behind us. And I know there are way more important things in the world than wrestling as far as COVID goes and how it's affected people's lives. But as a wrestling fan, we have lost a lot of great moments without the benefit of there being a live audience. And so I think to get that reaction back, to get the audience back so when somebody comes back for a big return or there's a big debut, some of the interpromotional stuff that we've been seeing, for example, on AEW Dynamite, all these moments that in front of a live audience, a packed live audience, 5, 10,000 people, people would just be going nuts for. We've been, you know, as fans, we've been deprived of, and the talent too. You know, you gotta think that talent, you know, when you have somebody who comes over and debuts in AEW and they come out to a mostly empty building, yeah, it's gotta be jarring. And they're probably thinking, man, if only I would have done this 6 months ago or 12 months ago or whatever, I could have had a packed crowd and gotten a nice big reaction. So we've missed out on a lot of those moments. We need to have that back. Wrestling just isn't as fun without it. We need to have that back, and hopefully that'll become a reality very soon. And that is this week in wrestling history. I hope you enjoyed that. Please keep sending in your questions. Don't have any time this week, but I do read everything you send me. Email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com, and you might hear your question here on the podcast, or possibly on an upcoming live inbox on YouTube the next time I do one, which is probably coming up, right after WrestleMania. I'm thinking we might commemorate 700 episodes when we hit Sound Off 700. That'll be, you know, a regular show, but then maybe we'll go on YouTube that night and do a celebratory live inbox stream on YouTube. We'll see. I got some plans. I got some ideas floating up here in the old noggin. And I'm always open to your suggestions as well. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. I do appreciate all of the new follows and a lot of the new listeners that we have picked up since the Chris Van Vliet interview. If you missed that, I got to chat with Chris. He got to interview me several weeks ago. That interview is up on his channel, and the reaction has been unbelievable. Some of the comments and the emails and tweets I received. So if you missed it, it's still up there. Go back and check that out. I'm going to be with you live this Wednesday after AEW Dynamite, talking their St. Patrick's Day Slam show and any other big news that might break during the week. Right back here with you again for episode 696 next Sunday. Of course, next Sunday is a pay-per-view day, so I'll be live on YouTube after Fastlane. And I may be live on YouTube at the end of this week with Fastlane predictions. So you're probably going to get a whole bunch of podcasts. I hope you're ready. Gonna be getting a lot of Solomonster coming up. There's enough of me to go around for everybody, though. Don't you worry. Don't you worry. So I hope you'll join me then, 696 next Sunday. Until then, be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a great week. If you're trying to get WrestleMania tickets this week, I wish you good luck, because I'm sure they're gonna go fast. And I will see you back here for more Sound Off very soon. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
So then we had, at the very end of the show, a segment in the ring with Alexa Bliss and Randy Orton. She called him a bitch, which is their go-to word on these shows, right? Didn't we hear Kevin Owens called Roman Reigns the same thing on Friday night? He called him a bitch. Alexa Bliss here called Randy Orton a bitch. Boy, you know, I can play that game too. Hey, Vince McMahon, step aside, bitch. There, see how easy that was?
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter, @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.